From the Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, this is Film Grok. Our movie this week is Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And actually, if you're listening to it when we're doing it, it's part of our fabulous Ape Week here at Film Grok. So, and as many of you know, the apes, or maybe you don't know, there were, an ape has been released from the cage. There was the Planet of the Apes series that came out in the early 70s, and there were five of them: Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and the final one, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, followed by, of course, an animated TV show and a TV series, too, which also had Roddy McDowall. For this Film Grok session, we're going to be doing Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Today we have...
Tim McMillan.
And...
Heidi Hilliker.
And me, Serge Delpierre. Our cue point for Beneath the Planet of the Apes, as it is often with, as I'm finding with movies from the early 70s, is, well, it's the very beginning of the film. So we can just get the whole experience as it starts. So let the film start, and then just as the first image is starting to fade up, you can just click it back just a little bit. It's a picture of a beach, the waves, and then Roddy McDowall starts talking. So that is our cue point for Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And at which point, once you've got it cued, we're going to talk for a little bit, then I'll count down 3, 2, 1, play, at which time you'll hit play, and then you'll be in sync with us, and you can listen to us while you're watching Beneath the Planet of the Apes, or you can listen to this while you're doing something like driving in your car, or jogging, or...
cooking a meal, going to the zoo.
Ooh, I like the zoo. What was it, the San Diego Zoo, the Los Angeles? Oh, that's an escape. Oh, we can't get ahead of ourselves. Mm-mm. Right. Okay.
No.
Okay. Forget. All right. So, let's talk about first times. Mr. McMillan?
Call me Mr. Sketchy, because I saw this when I was 10, and I haven't seen it again the entire duration of the film.
Ooh.
I've seen it in segments throughout the years. I remember not caring for this one that much in my recollections. Only because of it was so depressing. And yeah, it's just so cynical on mankind and the world and life. So for whatever reasons, I emotionally detached from it a bit. So I'd be interested to see what I think today.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, television airings over the years in bits and pieces. And I remember the ending big time.
I'm going to talk about that as soon as Heidi talks.
the very first Planet of the Apes film I saw with my father, who exposed me to most of my favorite sci-fi and action-related films when I was younger. I liked it so much, and it always kind of hung in my memory. And then we ended up getting Turner Classic Movies, and they ended up showing, like, from the entire series,
yeah.
One right after another. And, you know, I was pretty young, I think. I mean, I must have been maybe 12 when I watched the whole marathon. And
did you see it from the beginning, the first movie first?
Yep, yeah. First movie
so you watched,
first.
You watched That's Planet great. First.
Yep, and then watched it all the way through.
And so you That's watched super. Them essentially did night after night or all in one night?
How'd it was one it? Day.
Oh, my gosh.
So you saw, you saw all five... in a row?
In one day.
That is amazing.
Yeah. The first time seeing it.
That is the first
that
time.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it was pretty awesome. And I mean, I've seen the films again, you know, over the years. I you know, probably the last time I've seen any of them probably was at least like 6 to 10 years ago. But I had seen them after I saw them all that one day. I've seen them since. My older sister Helena and I really liked them. We would watch them together occasionally. But I think it's a lot of the reason why I've loved that kind of subgenre of sci-fi that, like, you know, good books like Brave New World would fall into, that kind of like satirical future, you know, like the very kind of like Philip K. Dick version of, you know, things as well. And I think that all kind of started with the Planet of the Apes films for me.
Wow.
That interest, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I'll come back to you in a second. Tim, what order did you see the films?
That's a good question. I can't recall.
And you saw it, now did you see Beneath in the theaters?
No, I saw it on television.
It was on television. Did you see any in the theaters?
No, I didn't see any in the theaters.
Okay.
And come to think of it.
And you haven't seen any in the theaters, right?
No.
Okay. All right. I saw Beneath the Planet of the Apes is the first film I saw, and I saw it in the theater.
That's cool.
Now,
cool.
I was aware of Planet of the Apes. In fact, I think for some reason I had trading cards Planet of the Apes. Like, ooh, it's Planet of the Apes trading cards.
I'll give you one Cornelius for 2-0.
Oh, but the images were kind of weird. Like, they had the one with the apes smiling over the dead human, you know, having the picture taken. I remember that one. I don't know. I think my mom threw them out or something, or I may have them somewhere. But then Beneath the Planet of the Apes came out in 1970, and we went to the theater, and that was the first one I saw. I was really excited, and we were in New York visiting my cousins, and I was like, oh, wow, it's Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So for me, this was Planet of the Apes. This was the universe. Then Planet of the Apes came out on TV in 1972, and that's when I had a chance to see it, because I hadn't seen Planet of the Apes, and there was no way to see it. There was no video, and they weren't running it on TV again. So I was like, oh, this is what it's all about. This came first, and that's how it fit into context. But for a long time, this was it. So when I saw this film, you know, it was Charlton Heston at the beginning, James Franciscus, Charlton Heston at the end, blows up the planet. Oh, I just spoil it for everybody. I hope you've seen this film already. So for me, it just carried the mystique. This is how mystique started with me. In fact, I had the soundtrack album by Leonard Rosenman and play it all the time, especially the explosion at the end. And I'd use it actually for sound effects for like little, you know, cassette little audio plays I do.
Fun.
Oh, no, I know what I did. I took the explosion at the end, and I somehow looped it, and I was trying to do like an earthquake sense around type of thing.
Wow.
Oh, what a kid will do. But it's interesting you say that you were 12 years old, because you were 10, and I think I was 10 years old, or even 9 years old when I saw it. But the thing with Planet of the Apes is that young kids were liking it. That's what they noticed. They weren't making them for kids, clearly.
Right.
Now they would, but they weren't.
And they'd be lame now if they made them for kids.
Oh, totally lame. But you're right. They are very cynical, but I think it's of the time, too. And I think it worked because it was of the time.
Yeah.
They're very, as far as statements on mankind and life and the future of our species and our place in the universe and our detriment
and how we
to everything
each other.
We touch.
And how, you know, how sentient beings treat each other. You know, I mean, that was that I always took that away with me every time I watched one of these films.
Very somber, very sobering social statements.
Yeah.
I mean, just it's like it hung on me after I watched Beneath. It was just my gosh.
But especially with the whole thing of it extended actually what Charlton Heston had, you know, his attitude had been in Planet of the Apes, which was he was basically misanthropic. He hated the whole human race. Everyone, you know, it sucked. It didn't know what it was doing, and he just wanted to get away. And here he's like, everything sucks. Everyone's died. Boom, I'm taking everyone out.
Disturbing. That's the word. It
very
disturbed
disturbing.
Me. It was a disturbing film to me. It shook me up, and I don't think I even knew why, but it just was shaking me up.
See, for me, it captured my imagination. I was just like,
me too. Yeah.
He blew up the planet. Oh, my God. Which, now, this is the whole thing I have to say. It is my contention that this is the greatest movie ending ever. Charlton Heston blowing up the planet. It doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, it's a pretty great ending.
You know?
In fact, you could probably put it over the ending of most other films.
Absolutely. Now, the only other ending that each even comes to mind, at least in my limited experience having seen many movies, but is a film called Birdie from the mid-80s by Alan Parker with Matthew Modine and Nicolas Cage. You probably have never heard of it. But if you ever watch it, that's a great ending, too. Not like this. The planet doesn't blow up or anything. But it is a great
ending
for a film. It sets itself up, and the movie is like, whatever. And great ending for that. Here, this is just, I don't know. This is more of, you know, in my DNA from being a child. So,
Heidi, do you have a favorite installment? Do you have a favorite film out of the franchise?
Did one
stick out to you?
Well, I'm always really fond of just Planet of the Apes, obviously, because that was the first one I had seen, and I had seen it several times before I had seen the sequels.
Okay.
So, of course, that one always really sticks out with me. And then, it's the last one where, like, the people are the apes are the slaves of the people?
Yes, Battle for the Planet.
Yeah, that one always stands out. I don't know why. And maybe it was because it was the last one that I saw. But I remember after we watched that marathon, my sister and I just being like, oh, I can't even. Like, I remember watching that one and being like, I can't even handle it anymore. Now the people are having the apes as slaves. What? And I don't know. That's always really set with me, that because of the idea that you could have something horrible done to you and then you'll just do it back again.
Interesting.
You know, and I think that's why that one always really stuck with me as well.
May I say that I think
yes,
Planet of the Apes franchise is the most inventive, reinventing itself for a series of films I can recall.
Well, that's interesting.
As far as the writing. And how, you know, going back to the well again and again, and yet creatively doing so. well, in the writing of turnabouts and twisting and perspective changing and making its commentaries as a through line throughout the entire thing, but switching who's saying it.
Well, the interesting thing is that this film starts essentially the different track of Planet of the Apes, going to the writing. Paul Dean, D-E-H-N, was the writer for the last four sequels. I mean, he did them all. He's British, yeah. And no, Ron, because I think Ron Serling and I don't remember who.
Pierre Boulle.
Pierre Boulle wrote the novel. Ron Serling did the first pass, and then I don't remember who did the second pass. Well, essentially, whatever on the Planet of the Apes thing. But then once they went to the sequels, then it changed. I mean, things changed in this. In this film, Roddy McDowall was not in it. David Watson plays Cornelius because he wasn't available because of some movie.
Ava Gardner movie.
The Ava Gardner.
The Ballad of Tamlin. Which was a debacle.
Oh,
for
buddy.
Mr. McDowell.
It's okay. He came back and basically became the king of the Planet of the Apes. But yeah, Paul Dean wrote them all.
So it had continuity in who was overseeing it.
And he was a really good. I mean, you can see his fingerprints all over the writing in the four in the sequels. So it's interesting to say that. Yeah,
I think it's the most inventive reinventing for a series to continue that I've seen.
Right. Let's get going. We can keep on talking about these things. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, pick up your remotes, or don't. And we're going to count down. So, 3, 2, 1, play. Ooh, look at that ocean.
That's a great shot.
Oh, it's really nice. It's really well shot.
And I like how this ties you back into the ending of the first one.
Yeah, it basically replays the ending from the first one. Yep. Then it extends and... with Taylor going out and then disappearing with the cheesier special effects, but that's okay.
Yeah. Of course, you have to mention they cut the budgets for each successive film, and it shows, unfortunately.
What I love about this as a sequel is that it takes the dialogue from the last, from the last scene in Planet of the Apes, and then basically put it and kind of recombine the visuals, which I really liked.
Well, you have to do two things. Please the people that saw the first movie and bring the people up to speed who never saw the first movie.
And that was me.
Right. And you'd think, a good point that you brought up, before there were so many like DVDs and videos out where people could go backtrack and watch a movie in a series like this was coming out where people wouldn't be able to.
Right.
A couple years had passed since you saw the last movie.
Yeah, 2 years, yeah. And actually what they did is once all the films were done in, 74, 75, they'd actually, at drive-ins, that's what we actually did. We did what you did on TCM, but we went to the drive-in, they had Ape Night.
Awesome.
And literally you could see all five films. I think we drove our parents crazy. It was like,
awesome.
We have to go.
I would have loved that. They never showed any Planet of the Apes films at my drive-in at home.
And did you know the actor? I always thought his name was Maurice Evans, but his name's Morris. Maurice Evans.
Pronounced Morris?
It's pronounced Morris.
He was on Bewitched.
Yeah.
He played...
the father.
Samantha's father.
Yeah.
Oh. He was great.
Shakespearean actor.
Excellent.
Classical actor.
So this is all rehash from... Yep.
The makeup in these movies is so good.
Hi, Nova. Linda Harrison. Doesn't say a word. of course, this is taking the footage from the previous film. So this is all Franklin Schaffner's work. But it just sets it up well.
Yeah, it's really good.
I don't think this... Yeah, I think that shot wasn't Planet of the Apes. Now, the deal with Charlton Heston is I think they came to him and said, we'd like you to be in it, of course, Chuck. And he said, no, but I'll be in the beginning and the end. You have to kill me off.
This is one savvy actor. Get this. They come to Charlton Heston. He says, okay, I'll make you a deal. I show up in the beginning and I disappear. But for the rest of the film, they're trying to find me. So what it is he does 2 days' work or something.
And he's still like the main character.
And then everyone's talking about him.
Yeah.
And the whole movie's about him, even though when he's not on screen.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to do any work, and then he comes back at the end, and he said, I will come back at the end if I get killed off.
Right.
And he wanted to blow up the world so the franchise would end.
Weird.
So the franchise would end. It was his attempt, so they wouldn't milk it and go on and exploit him in future sequels.
Right.
And he thought by blowing up the world, there would never be another movie.
Fool.
Little did he know about this science fiction.
That's right. Natalie Trundy.
Natalie Trundy.
You should mention, Serge, her connection to this.
Natalie Trundy is Arthur P. Jacobs' wife, but...
Arthur P. Jacobs is the producer.
Was the producer. He was basically oversaw the whole thing. And you have to understand, I'm watching Beneath the Planet of the Apes for the first time.
And you're like, what's this?
And I'm like, what's this?
Right. And I'm, gosh, yeah.
I get at the beginning. And there you go. Actually, that shot that we had there was not in Planet of the Apes, the low angle on him.
Yeah.
I think they must have pulled it from the other takes.
Oh, my gosh.
They had
brilliant.
A huge and brouhaha so, with Charlton Heston by saying, God damn them all to hell.
Yeah. I
mean, the cussing, he said, no, it's totally appropriate.
And now we're into the new movie. And I think Ted Post directed this.
Yes. Right, which I don't know his other work.
I looked
was
up
he TV
point,
or? I sounds it, like a TV name.
TV-ish. John Chambers. Yeah, John Chambers did the makeup again. Milton Krasner. And I just like how it picks it up.
Yep.
Now Dan Stripeak, he's the one who actually took over for all the makeup for I think for the rest of the films. John Chambers basically
did
the first
his
film
thing.
Set. Yeah. So this was like the beginning. I mean, this was just a sequel. Now going back, L.B. Abbott, who was very
these are all
big,
the 20th Century Fox guys. Yeah.
L.B. Abbott did Towering Inferno, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
20th Century Fox, yeah. And William Krieber, art direction, a lot of the sets and a lot of the look is due to William Krieber.
And let's note the music, of course, the Leonard Rosenman.
Which I call atonal. Fantastic. It's very good for the film.
Yep.
Yeah. And I
dare you to find a melody line, but it's very good for the film.
I hear it. I love the font of the
I
titles.
Do too.
Very
70s. I do too.
And they carried it through the whole series, which was awesome. See, okay. Paul Dean and Mort Abrams.
But I like it. Like, they own it. And it looks, I mean, it fits really well with the way that they have the entire opening shot, too. There's just something very, like, artistic and pop art about the whole thing.
Yeah. Going back to what you were saying earlier, but, and I know you and I talk about this off, you know, off mic, but I think this really kind of introduced me to the whole idea of, like, post-apocalyptic fiction.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably the film that probably was the template for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, me
you
too.
You see the first one, and you blow up the world.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is interesting. So now we see this, and I'm like, wow. That's a really good crash set.
It is.
I like how they've art directed it.
This spaceship design, which they use throughout the series, well, at least the first three, right? The spaceship was in the first
This shows up in Escape. Yeah.
Is a beautiful design. And there's James Franciscus.
What a great actor.
I've always liked James Franciscus, and I thought he was underrated, and I thought he didn't get enough breaks feature-wise.
He did a really good series in the early 70s called Longstreet, where he played a blind detective in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And he also had a series called Mr. Novak, where he was a school teacher.
That was earlier.
That was earlier.
I don't remember that.
He's known for Mr. Novak and Longstreet, predominantly.
Skipper.
And I always thought James Franciscus had the coolest voice. His speaking voice is great.
He's got great presence, too.
I really like the wardrobe. I like the costume design of their NASA, their NASA uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a little dated, I guess, to like that 60s, 70s era, that like retro futuristic, I like to call it. But I think that they really carry over, actually. Like, if I'm watching this just right now, I could see someone in the future wearing that.
Yeah.
That's what I'd like, actually, even what the apes wear, their clothing as well. I think just really well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
Who did the costume design for this? Do we know?
It's not Edith Head.
Yeah, no, it's not.
One of the few movies that isn't.
Let me check on the internets.
I'd be curious to know. Because it is that really, like, to me, it's what I always thought, too, would be like that that kind of, that post-apocalyptic kind of future or like that... that, I don't know, that kind of parallel future, you know, would always be something a little bit more simple. Like, that's what the future was instead of, like...
Streamlined.
More streamlined instead of, like, gaudy and flashy. It would be more practical.
Right. Well, these are the same costumes as the first movie.
Yes.
That Chuck Heston was
Morton Haack, Haack.
Morton Haack. Well done.
It's a good thing Morton wasn't a director.
Right.
It's a hack director. Don't want to...
Or a writer.
I remember interviews
He did Planet of the Apes and Beneath Planet of the Apes.
So this is his costume design.
Yeah.
We're looking at.
Yeah, so he carried it over in that, you know, the same.
I like the emblems. Yeah, I like the NASA.
This is a good transfer, actually.
It is nice.
Yeah.
The blues look good. The blues of Francisca's eyes pop. Very nice.
Of course, here he's talking about... I think he's talking about... They talk about, you know, following...
Taylor
through the Hassline curve. I don't know if they mentioned the Hassline curve here. I think they might have. That's when they might have brought it up.
So it was introduced in this film? Or was it? Did they talk about it in the first movie?
Definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
So they carry it over.
The whole Hasline curve, and of course, with the payoff is an escape. We get Dr. Hasline.
Right, Eric Braeden.
In the form of Eric Braeden.
We have some 60s zooms.
Oh, yes.
I like it. I mean, you don't always need it, but again, look how cool like the undershirt part of this costume is. But it's it's just interesting. I want to wear that, actually.
I wonder if this is the same location as the first movie. It looks like it could be one of those same locations.
Maybe in the same general area.
I want to see what the rest of that ship looks like. The back end. We never get to see the back end.
I mean, if we go down the science route here, the science doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it makes just enough sense for us to accept.
They feed you just enough, and they don't bury themselves by saying too much, so you can see how it doesn't work logically.
Right, because if you really, really want to dig into it.
I remember interviews with James Franciscus. He said this movie was fraught with chaos because of the writing. It really wasn't locked in.
Oh.
And they were still coming together as they were shooting, even. It was sort of slapped together and hurried.
But I like the fact that right off the bat, this is sort of like what Lost would do. Lost, you know, would leave off an episode, and then the next episode would start somewhere, and you'd have to reorient yourself in the same way.
Yeah.
Here, they've thrown us somewhere else, and we have to reorient ourselves. And what's great, of course, he's our entry into what's going on here. He doesn't know what's going on, so we don't know, and
right.
It gives us a chance to re-educate ourselves, and of course,
through him,
what happened with Taylor, as opposed to them figuring it out. Though I can see them having worked this out on the set.
Now, my question is: was Linda Harrison still Zanuck's girlfriend in Beneath the Planet of the Apes?
I think so. Oh, going back to Natalie Trundy. Natalie Trundy also was in the four sequels.
All four.
In here, she's a mutant. Escape, she's one of the doctors with Bradford Dillman.
That's right.
And then in the last two, she plays Lisa.
And Lisa was who?
Caesar's honey, wife.
Oh, Caesar's
his honey.
Honey.
Girlfriend.
His honey.
Honey, honey in Conquest, wife in battle.
That's how we do it in the Planet of the Apes. We have honeys.
My ape honey.
His S.O.
That's a nice shot.
That's a really nice shot.
Yeah.
It's a nice shallow depth of field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice little zoom there.
Right.
And the framing works just right.
Now he's piecing together everything. And we're seeing how he can, the way they're structuring it, we're seeing how he essentially is learning at least parts of what this world, that she can't talk.
Right.
And then, of course, Taylor. Now, writing-wise, I like the editing coming up here, right, by the way. That's great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where they just flash to him. And then we're into what happened, and we're getting her memory, which is cool.
Yeah.
What's good is that in this
Unfortunately, she sees herself from this angle rather than looking out into his face seeing her thoughts. Sorry, but...
But the interesting thing...
Sometimes the way you remember things, you know, like in a dream you see yourself sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
I actually do a lot in dreams.
You see yourself?
I see myself. Like it's like a first, like, what are those? Like a
third person.
Yeah, like that.
Third person shooter.
Like a third person shooter, yeah.
Camera's right behind you.
Right.
You never see your face. I don't know. I really don't know. I think sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I dream in movies.
Yeah.
All my dreams are movies. It's just the way I dream. What I was going to say about Nova.
That's just the way I dream.
On that note.
And Nova.
Nova, I dream about Nova all the time. And that costume she's wearing. I'm sorry.
She's inspired a lot of dreaming
over the years. Yeah.
But this allowed it. Essentially, we got to know Nova some more. I mean,
right.
Her personality. We saw a bit of her there. I'm trying to think in the rest of the film. We don't really, because she just hangs out and she follows. And then later at the end of the film, of course, we get to see some personality from her. And okay, here's the bad special effects.
Yeah, but it's good for the time, whatever.
For 60, for 70, yeah.
But like I say, you can see it in each successive film, the budget being cut.
But being it that it, we know that it's an optical illusion, you could rationalize that, well, of course it would look kind of cheesy because,
right,
you know.
Because it's not real.
It's of course it's not. It's, a, it's an illusion.
It's an optical illusion with a bad optical printer.
Yeah. Because that's what the mutants have, bad optical printers. That's
true.
They don't. See, here's that low-angle shot again. I bet you they shot a bunch of stuff low-angle like this, so, like on the beach, just to fill
cool.
stuff in.
That's a nice
that's
little
a really good special effect. I think I read how they did it at one point. But, I mean, essentially it's taking two plates and then adding a third optical effect of the dirt falling and following it.
Merging them on the horse footage with the...
Yeah.
A fact.
And now here, of course, that's a matte painting that they're looking at, the cliff face, which then they just take away.
Right.
Well, that's actually the cliff face. What a great actor. Charlton Heston, after not having had a haircut for a month. I don't know, however long he was on the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, I love that he talks to himself a lot. But I think one would, though. I think if you were alone, you know what I mean?
He does that. What we, you know, when we did Omega Man, it was the same thing. He talks to himself. But yeah, exactly.
No one monologues like Charlton Heston.
That's right.
Or soliloquies. Two soliloquy.
And I think his thing also with the sequel is that, I mean, he's Charlton Heston. I don't do sequels. Because at the time, sequels were definitely looked down upon because sequels were not even what sequels are these days. They were vastly insignificant, thrown out into theaters, and they disappear.
Right. They were just made to make some money.
That's why he didn't want to cheapen himself. And he thought with this, he would kill his character off, blow up the world, and it would be over. Little did he know how smart the suits were.
And little did
at 20th Century Fox.
But it was, well, I mean, if that's
one, the goodness of the stories.
Okay, bad optical effect, but really cool.
Right.
That freaked me out. Oh, I also had the comic. That's right. That's what helped me actually learn the film. Because once I saw it, then I didn't see it for a while. So I bought the comic. It was from Key Comic. It was from Key Comics. So I could essentially relive what the story was. Well,
right.
I mean, that's the way.
Before videotape.
And then I also got the book. I have it upstairs.
Oh, the merchandising on this series, forget about it. It's the most merchandised franchise
behind
Star Wars. Yeah.
She's like, I don't know where Taylor is,
has
man.
That's right. Have we anyone ever seen a Linda Harrison film where she talks?
Yes.
Which was, and can she act, or did they?
Airport 75.
Oh, that's right.
She was under the name Augusta Summerland.
She was the assistant of Gloria Swanson.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. What do I win?
Ooh, touche. Okay. And who was the guy who slept through the whole flight?
Oh,
what's wrong with her feet? The weird way she was holding her feet.
I think she's scared of being on the horse.
So I don't recall her in Airport 75. Could she handle dialogue?
She's an awkward human being, I'm going to say.
Could she handle dialogue? Do you remember
her? She was okay.
I'm just wondering if...
I don't think she did much anything else.
You know, we make her a mute because the woman can't act. I was just wondering.
She looked... I don't know. I think you know what? When you think back to Planet of the Apes, she did a fair amount. I mean, listen, you don't have to have lines to do acting.
True. I mean, as far as a speaking voice, as far as handling dialogue.
Yeah, I think from my vague recollection, it's not like in Singing in the
Rain.
Exactly. What's her face? She didn't have what's her face's Lena.
Lena Lamont on. And they kept their standing set.
They kept the standing set, which was out on the ranch.
It's a beautiful set.
I don't think it's standing anymore. Is it?
No.
They took it down?
No. It wasn't that sturdy.
Oh, the zooms kill
eroded.
Me, man. The zooms kill me. But I know it works. But it was just
it's very television.
Time.
That's why I'm thinking Ted Post was sort of... But that was the DP, I know, but still.
I kind of like it, though, because it gives it this like strange, like uncomfortable feeling that I think just kind of goes with the overall, you know, message and look of the film.
Now, that's interesting. I mean, that you get in that context is really cool.
I don't,
because I just, I'm like, oh, it's 70s, you know, TV, zoom in.
It just makes me feel kind of like, ugh. You know, like, I mean, I would feel maybe if I came over a ridge and saw this, like, bizarre ape community for the first time, I might feel a little like, whoa, I'm zooming in.
Okay.
It's weird. What's down there?
Now, this is ambitious for their budget.
Oh,
and if you look, you always want to look in
bad masks.
Look in the
bad masks.
Look in the back row.
Right.
Don't look in the front row. Look in the back row and see how bad it gets.
Now, the actor here, General Ursus, is James Gregory.
Yep.
Character actor.
Mm-hmm.
Big in TV and film in the 60s and 70s.
He did everything.
Maybe into the 80s, but I think a lot of people passed away already from this film.
And that voice, James Gregory's voice, awesome. That gruff voice. He's that urban detective type voice.
There's a long. Now, this is interesting because we only saw the Lawgiver not even in the court in Planet of the Apes, but we saw it, I think, only when Taylor was like running through like that kind of church area.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So now we actually see the Lawgiver.
Expand that.
And we're hearing it referred to, though they did refer to the Lawgiver, of course, at the end of Planet, at the beginning of
yes.
this. Yes. I love it. It's a nightmare. And of course, they're exploiting and basically telling the story of what was happening in the late 60s, early 70s. There was Vietnam. There
right.
were protests at this time.
Yep.
And there was definitely the people who wanted to go at war and stay at war. And I mean, Nixon escalated the war and went into Cambodia. And there were those who said, we need to get out of Vietnam. And this was a way of, in fact, you can see little protests going on in the background.
Yeah.
And so, of course, then they really plumb this, which they didn't plumb this in Planet of the Apes, where you have definitely the girlies who were for war. And go Kim Hunter.
Kim Hunter did not want to do this movie. She had such bad memories of the makeup from the first movie.
No.
She had some bad psychological problems with it at the beginning, and then just the hassle of doing it every day.
Psychological problems with it, like feeling
claustrophobic.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they I guess, paid her enough, and here she is.
Now,
well, she's probably glad in retrospect that she just sucked it up and did it.
Oh, yeah.
Because what a fun experience.
And she did a third one, too.
Yeah, but completely unique experience, too.
And she got to continue. Well, this film is not so much about her. I mean, her and Cornelius are more definitely supporting characters in this film, much
yes.
more than in the first one.
But they got theirs in the next one.
Oh, they totally got theirs, which was great. Now, this is interesting. With the plot point they're creating is, you know, with General Ursus and with the gorillas saying that there's the Forbidden Zone, which in definitely Planet of the Apes was forbidden. You didn't go there at all. Lawgiver
yeah.
says so. And here they're basically, it's echoing expansionist, you know, desires of moving in and, see, expanding.
Yep.
Of our ineluctable power. That's some good language there.
Wow.
And to invade.
Now, if you look at the masks, the principals have an appliance over their mouth mm-hmm. so they can speak through it. It's a separate piece that is adhered to the facial mask.
Right.
You look at the background people, it's all one piece.
And, yeah, it's just hanging there.
And their eyes are not...
It betrays itself in the eyes. That's the
eyes
yeah.
are...
And in the mouth, I think, because the mouths look lifeless.
Yeah.
But still, whatever. I mean, they couldn't have put that kind of effort into every single person. I get it.
Right. With the budgets being cut, yeah,
yeah.
That was a... I mean, the makeup budget was a substantial amount of the first movie's entire budget.
Yeah. And the only reason they could do this is because they had standing sets, costumes, and everything. So that obviously the makeup would be one of the big expenses. Now, that's playing Cornelius is David Watson, as we mentioned before. Yeah. Roddy McDowall went off and worked with Ava Gardner. So now we're back to Brent, essentially. And essentially, we're introduced to the plot by him watching and observing and learning what's going on there.
Now, I mentioned about David Watson. Kim Hunter had this to say. David and I never really got to know each other very well. We had very little to do in the whole thing, but he was fine and he was dear. But he wasn't Roddy, and I wanted Roddy.
Ooh, yeah.
Aw.
Yeah.
But David Watson's speaking voice was very similar to Roddy McDowell's.
Right.
With the English sound.
And I mean, it happens.
So that was good for them to use him.
Right. And now we're into the action of the film, and now, you know, now it goes back to being Brent's story. I mean, essentially it was Brent's story because he was watching it, but now we're really back to this.
And again, the art direction on even like the guns.
The gun, yeah.
Like the, what an incredibly inventive idea to, you know, and it looks like it's just kind of like a slip cover over like a normal looking kind of gun. Like, to, you know, a normal to us, obviously.
Yeah.
That's what I like when people can do things like that with sci-fi, you know, because you don't have to alter things all that different to make them different,
right.
you know, or to make it seem like it's an alternate world or something.
But I like how they expand the ideas and now they have a steam bath with the apes. I hate to say we're seeing naked apes right now. I hope you realize.
We're not seeing all the junk.
Well, I'm glad the junk's hidden in the hair. That's all I can say.
And you just know, budget-wise, they're like, oh, an entire ape suit for this scene.
Yeah.
You need all the hair.
Maybe with Zaius, they were like, okay, we're not going to do the whole suit.
Cover up.
Yep. So, and now we're getting, you know, now we're getting into the people who, I mean, essentially the power structure. You essentially have the general, and you have Morris Evans. You have Dr. Zayas. I think that's optical steam.
If we had a camera move, we'd be able to find out for sure.
But now they're kind of revealing a little bit of what we saw, too, with Taylor.
Yeah.
No, that's...
With the wall of fire.
Yeah, they're discussing,
yeah, they're discussing how their scout now saw the same thing we saw.
And so now, you know, he's talking about essentially... Well, just feeding the expansionist, you know,
right?
Desire. We need resources. We've run out of resources. An interesting difference from the first film, because we never really got to dig into or find out about. Well, the one thing we did find out about is how they deal through Taylor's eyes with humans, but it was almost through the context of like, I'm a human from the 20th century. What are you doing? And here it's more like, well, this is where we live, and this is what we're doing, and these are our politics.
Right, yeah, it's
without the humans.
Right, it's more related into what is important for the apes, you know, what their issues are, how they govern their society.
It is very interesting how they reveal their politics as the films go on.
And that's what I think makes it, you know, a smart script.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. I hadn't seen this in a little while. Oh, I like the little lawgiver statue over there. I like the picture. I didn't ever notice that.
Aww.
Wow. Yeah. That is so high key lighting.
True.
It's just so high key.
I like all the things in there. There's a loom. There's the scrolls.
Right.
You just get a taste.
This is their house.
This is how they live.
You know what's funny to me is I always have this feeling when I think of the Planet of the Apes films, they feel very like Roman Empire to me. And now, just even, you know, watching this right now, I understand exactly why I feel that way. The steam rooms and the looming and even the way that the houses are set up and the scrolls, you know, that kind of like building a republic and building a government but not knowing what to do yet. The expansion, the slavery, it all actually.
The original vision was to be high tech.
Was to be
for the apes.
Like 20th century.
But they didn't have the budget.
Yeah. So. It's so much better like this.
But it works. And essentially what you're looking at is a society without electricity. And I'm assuming without plumbing, indoor plumbing. But you never know.
But
I think they have some kind of plumbing of some sort because they've got agriculture and they can handle that.
But they're still advanced in that way that like the Roman Empire was very advanced with agriculture. And, like, you know, using water or using different kinds of mechanics. You know, obviously human-operated or animal-operated mechanics for things. But, you know, the same way. It's that same kind of feeling, like they're advanced for what they are.
Right, exactly. They've taken
advanced for what they have.
They've taken it, exactly, as far as they can take it. I want to get back to a point earlier about Brent meeting Nova. I'm like, okay, the Forbidden Zone is pretty damn big, and she's going to run into him. Okay, I'll get it.
Well, you want to get a convenience. Talk about Escape from the Planet of the Apes for a minute. As far as it's a little too convenient to actually take place in real life.
Well.
But that's why there's stories.
I'm just focusing on this movie.
I know what I'm saying, though, that in order for the series and franchise to survive, they had to take those drastic liberties.
I like that.
Among other things, I'm a trained vet.
Yeah, exactly. So he gets up to speed on the topsy-turviness really quickly, whereas it took Taylor quite a while to in the first one, but that's what it was about, Taylor discovering, whereas here it's more advancing story, and actually the story is not, his story is finding Taylor so that they can quote-unquote get back, because he doesn't know, that's right, he doesn't know yet.
Right.
He doesn't know that he's on Earth, and they don't know that this is
and
Earth.
And there's no way to go back.
I like the little roof she cooks up. Oh, there's the Cornelius.
I love the way that they walk and run.
The Cornelius walk.
Oh, it's so fantastic.
Your arms have to just hang at your sides, right? The arms do not move when you do the run.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you bounce. There's a bounce in your step, right? I'm trying to get this down.
Yes, there is.
Okay, bounce in your step, arms don't move.
Sometimes I will do the Cornelius walk.
Cornelius shuffle.
Oh.
He's like, oh, domestic violence. What's your problem? I'm not listening.
Which also, again, makes it feel very like Roman to me. Mm. You know, that they're not this super advanced society because women still don't even have the same equality.
What I really like actually here, I mean, once again, Zaius' character is just well followed through, is that Zaius essentially listens and knows with the politics that are going on with power, but he knows that he has to somehow stay on top of it and manage it all. And he doesn't think it's necessarily right, but he knows that he's got to stay on top.
Oh, those gorillas.
Right.
They're so stupid.
Well, you know, it's a metaphor for human aggression.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, the way they structured it with the gorillas and with the chimpanzees and with the orangutans,
right,
was that each one was a metaphor for different aspects of humanity. Cornelius is just like, shut the hell up, please. And his relationship with him has changed, too. In the first one, he was very much, I need you to do this, and I'm going to throw you in jail. I mean, I'm going to basically, you know, I'm going to arrest you. Actually, he has them arrested in the first film.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's basically telling, well, this is his way of saying, I'm going, and you guys are in charge.
Handing over the baton.
That's kind of nice that he does that.
Well, because he knows that they're the only ones smart enough. I mean, as far as what he regards as, you know, I mean, they're all intellectuals, as they so self-proclaim themselves to be several times. And I think that that's, you know, I think someone that considers themselves to be that that bright and brilliant wouldn't want to just like leave civilization, even if he doesn't agree with what these other people, like their beliefs are. Mm. He wouldn't want to leave it to anyone he thought was dim-witted.
Everyone else,
right.
Yeah. I like to get rid of this too. The dog tags.
Did you know that James Franciscus was on crutches the first 2 weeks of shooting?
From what?
He ripped out his foot on the tennis court. He tore the ligaments.
Oh.
And so it was shot chronologically, so the crash site was the first thing.
Oh.
So he said, well, and you see in a couple of shots at the beginning, he's limping.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, it makes sense for the crash site. So after 2 weeks, he had to be in the loincloth and like sandals and everything.
And so
he had to be off the crutches from that point on, but he had a really bad injury.
Right. And now he's just found out basically that he can't speak. He's found out the whole thing that humans don't. Well, now, I mean, that he knew from Nova, essentially.
Right, but
he's
that
pieced it all together.
It's more now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
It's everyone. He's got a quick taste, a quick lesson in basically in the first half hour of what it's like to be human in the...
Right.
Oh, what year is this again? Oh, this is the 40th century, if we're going by our counting. The 40th century, it's got a ring to it, you know?
It does.
Hi, I'm from the 40th century.
Gosh, I love it. I just love like the shame of having to put on these rags, you know?
Yeah.
I am an elevated life form. There goes now what? You got me wearing...
But that's
like,
what it is, and he's thrown into it really quickly.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Now,
it's actually pretty amazing how well he adapts. If you want to like think about it, I mean, that's...
But he's an astronaut.
Pretty incredible.
Astronauts are incredible people.
Yeah, but I don't think most astronauts... are prepared to like wake up on a foreign planet where like apes rule and they have to wear loincloths.
But this one is.
You got to keep your options open.
See, this one is a really cool one.
That's why I think he's so awesome, though.
Well, exactly. You know? That's what makes him a hero, is right. That he can adapt that quickly. They shot the horse. Oh, man. I hate when they do that. And now he gets a taste of... You see, what I like is that now they're basically, you know, we get to relive elements of the first film, like being chased.
That wasn't him. In that last shot, James Franciscus.
I
that was a stuntman because of his bad foot.
I didn't.
Oh, that makes sense.
I didn't notice him.
That's him.
Yep.
But that other shot, it did not look like him.
But it's okay. What I'm saying is that they're able to capture certain elements from the first one and put it in the second one. I only bring this up because recently I had the opportunity to watch Tron Legacy, which I know you and I haven't had a chance to talk about.
No, but I loved it.
But I had... I felt it was shortchanged. I wanted to see more of...
Action.
More of the action. Okay.
Yeah, that's what everybody said about it.
Yeah.
It's like they
touched on some of the action things from the first one, and then we were out of it.
But I still feel like the first movie isn't really as action-packed as people like to pretend it is.
Oh, I understand. I'm not claiming the first one's a classic. Well, it is a classic.
It is a classic. I love Tron.
But
what you were saying is you like that they're carrying over.
Here that they carried, they had enough of the action and enough of the elements of it from the first one so we can still have a taste of what the place is like. It still informs this story and still makes me feel like, okay, I feel more like I'm in the same world as the first one and I don't feel like I need anything else and now I can continue on with this film. And he's blonde and they're all staring at him.
Yep.
Okay, was there supposed to be another scene somewhere in there? Because he just stared at him.
I think they were just, he was recognizing that they were so different, and and they were recognizing he was so different.
That's a dangerous stunt. Wow. And this whole, now this is an expansion once again. Of before we saw them essentially just hunting them, now we're seeing them
training.
Use humans as essentially...
like dummies.
Well, what's it called when you...
That's for training.
Well, it's for training, yeah, exactly. As, well...
Do those calisthenics.
That's right.
That's right. Stay limber.
And now he gets to see up close. Structure-wise, it's great because he's been far away. He's seen the chimpanzees from far, and now he's really getting up close and seeing it.
It's a nice reveal of their society through his eyes.
Again, it also still feels very Roman to me.
And also, it's integral to what's happening because in the plot, basically they're gearing up.
Well, yeah, they're training to invade.
They're training to invade, and they're just basically killing humans as practice and training. And as we're seeing a lot of it, we've seen at least about 8 or 9 of them there.
Wow. Yeah.
What a great sci-fi premise where you actually get to invest and learn so much about a society.
Yeah.
An alien-esque society.
And man, nothing would have been so awesome as to have been one of these human extras in these films. Nothing. That just standing in like some cage, like jumping around like a mad person. Yeah. Give me a 10-hour day like that. I'm in. Because they're always like, look at the... I mean, these people are really committed to like looking like a bunch of basket cases.
Yeah. This is the same set that they used in the first film, which is good. You're reusing the sets again. Oh, and now Ursus is like... Oh, sorry, target practice. And then, of course, the difference from the first film is that, you know, the military wasn't telling them what to do, but clearly here...
So you would want to be the one climbing the cage?
Yeah, look how much fun they're having.
Hey, Heidi,
look how much fun they're having.
There you are.
I mean, that's basically what these people just do all day, is they just jump around the jungle gym. Yeah, it looks so, like, what? So much fun.
You have done supernumerary work, have you not? You do know that was probably like 5 hours of speaking in the sun, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, the stage stuff is one thing, but the location.
Yeah, being an extra is quite the experience. I think if anyone's ever interested in how things are done, it's a good way to see is by being
it's
an
totally
extra
fun.
For a while. You can do it for a few months. I think you tap out at about 6.
I think it's fun unless
you get a good gig.
Yeah.
A good continuing gig.
But a lot
there
of
are
times,
professional background that just go and go and go and go.
Well, that's when they get the good gigs. That's
yep,
the whole
the
thing.
High paying gigs
and
the,
you know, the
good
indoor
union
stuff
things,
on the continuing shows.
But still, I mean, you always have a place to sit down and like rest and stuff like that.
On the better films.
Even on like smaller things. I was an extras wrangler on like a few like really low budget films, and they still get a place to go and sit and be quiet.
He's doing his own stunt there.
Relax.
Which we have to remember, he has a bad foot.
Right.
Talk about, and that's the stuntman right there. That's the same stuntman that was running down the hill in the other shot.
Sorry,
that's probably got to be the stunt guy right there.
Ugh.
Maybe it's not. Ooh. It looked like him.
Yeah, but they wouldn't let him do that.
I know, but it looked like him.
Now here, I will complain a little bit because I'm a bit of a purist, but I mean, I know they had to do the combination of some rear projection stuff, and it just...
They had a zoom into Nova's face in a couple of shots ago, and it was with a rear screen in the background. It looked terrible.
That was a good stunt. It hurt, but it was a good stunt where the ape got knocked off. You were saying about background?
Oh, nothing important.
Okay.
I think I finished that.
Right. I mean, it's great experience. It's just there's different ones.
Well, I know people as far as the best gigs for background are TV series.
Absolutely. I know some people
they
did
can go
ER
for years and years and years and years.
they were, you know, walking wounded on the staff, stuff like that.
But this would still be way more fun.
I did Just Shoot Me for about 5 or 6 episodes.
Well, a friend of mine
that was
on...
It was a great experience.
A friend of mine did West Wing for like 6 years or something.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's a great gig.
Yeah.
Now, you see, the interesting thing is I saw this first, so I'm like, I'm used to this. When I see Planet of the Apes and I see them kind of do the same thing towards the end, I'm like, wait a minute, I've seen this before, kind of. And then, of course, you know, I pieced it together, but it's fine. Those are some good-looking horses.
Yeah, they are. Those ones are definitely not going to the glue factory, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, no. Oh, well, that is a beautiful horse. Look at that. And they're riding without saddles. Ouch. Oh, they were before. What am I saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I never pieced it together, but okay.
Well, I'm watching that stunt man go in and out of these shots. He's got a stunt guy that's doing a lot of the riding.
He does a lot of physical work. So here's an ape, and he's... Okay, so this is interesting. So, oh, okay, that's right, because they come after them. All right, I know where we are in the film.
A lot of location stuff.
Well, this is all the ranch. This is the ranch. Yeah, I mean, we've been watching this sequence. I mean, I feel like I got it and it works, but it feels like in terms of the pacing, it's a little wanting.
It's going
In terms of the writing, exactly. It's just been going on and on.
Chase, right. chase.
In that sense, that's where it's a little weak, I'd say, in terms of the writing, because why are we going so long on that? But it's okay. I mean...
Well, it's just showing, you know, this is how hard it is to get away from them.
Yeah, oh, that's true. And that may be more of a directing thing than a writing thing.
It looks to me like Franciscus's stuntman has thinner hair.
Okay.
So every time you see a guy with more receding hairline.
That's
Devil's Tower.
Yeah, sure. That's a nice view. That must be out like out by Malibu. Oh, yeah.
That's got to stink, you know, doing these films. You're in loincloth and you're just...
You're barefoot.
Running.
And you're barefoot.
Jumping, falling.
They're going barefoot over rocks.
Films are very physical.
I have to say Nova doesn't seem... She seems so weak sometimes that it kind of like grosses me out.
Well, she's mute and she's kind of dumb.
Yeah, ooh. She's pretty stupid.
She is stupid. She's, you know...
But she also just seems like physically really weak sometimes, you know? Like, the fact that she's even, like, made it this far in her life, I'm really shocked by.
Well, the way they portray all the humans, they're all mostly like that. They're all, like, very weak, timid. They're not aggressive at all. And now the movie really begins for me.
Now we change. Now we get to the change.
I mean, I see what you're saying, but it seems like with all the humans, and in a way her challenge was to stay, not be too smart. Okay, now this is the big reveal, and he comes down, and he's like, wait a minute.
I remember this was freak. This was very freaky to me when I saw it when I was 10 years old.
This essentially, told me what the story was. Oh, she's still carrying the dog tags. That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
And he's starting to piece
this is a really
together.
This is a really awesome. It's like starting from the second they walk in here and you see the tiles. This is where it gets juicy.
I never looked at the New York subway the same again. It was awesome. And I saw this in New York, too.
Well, and you can tell right away that that's where they're at. They're in a subway. I mean, the second they walk in, you see those tiles. You just know.
Yeah. And I think you do see the name of the station. And he's like, oh, damn, I know where I am.
What a great scene for an actor, what he's doing right here. Wouldn't you kill to do a scene like that this type of thing? This is a great set.
It's a great set. What is it?
And it's lit well. That was lit well,
actually. It's Greensboro Plaza. Yeah. Oh, Queensboro.
Queensboro. Yeah.
I don't know my New York subway well enough to say where it is.
But I love this. I mean, if you really think about it, look at the landscape out there. Like, what would have happened to the earth? What would have had to gone through over how much time in order for the landscape of New York City to be that of, like, the Pacific's Southwest?
Yeah, and exactly. To look like Malibu.
Right. I mean, but that's... So many things would have to happen for
but
that.
That's what captured my imagination so much when I saw this. It's like, oh wow, it's New York,
and, right?
You know, I mean, you know, actually now I'm being reminded. I think I was, I read comics back then, and yeah, there you go, New York. New York is a summer festival, and he's like, damn it.
The realization.
I was I think DC had a comic called Strange Adventures.
Oh yeah, Strange Adventures. I think that's DC.
Yeah, and I don't remember. It was Strange. Yeah, and of course they had Adam Strange in it, but they also had something called Atomic Knights. And it was shortly around this time, and I got it, and it was the same thing. They were superheroes in the post-apocalyptic radioactive world, and the nuclear war had started at some point. And of course, the whole idea of a nuclear war was was very relevant on everyone's mind because of the tension with Russia at the time, the arms race. And essentially, in this story, they kind of went back and discovered how it had all started. It started by mole people who lived underground. I'm like, wait a minute, that's like Beneath the Planet of the Apes. A little different, but it was all this thing. At the same time, the point is that it helped to capture my imagination.
Yeah,
on that whole idea.
The great lawgiver.
That's a good scene.
Yeah,
it's an interesting scene. They're going to the lawgiver who actually was for peace, and they're praying to him for war and for righteousness.
You have a lot of praying and worshiping in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
This scene and the mutants underneath the
earth,
what they worship and what they pray to.
The mutants worship something, Tim? I'm not.
Yeah, I think they do.
Yes.
If I recall correctly.
The bomb.
The set was really amazing, too, in that last scene. Like, the way that has that kind of, like, half spherical, like, stone structure around the room.
Right.
Really inventive.
You know, earlier, I think why I knew, I talked about the protest that you could see is, I think, in the comic.
Yeah.
There's, like, one of the things that was cut out, and in the comic, you had them, like, break up the protest or whatever. I don't know. There was more of a scene with the protesters outside versus the gorillas. Oh, no, here it is.
Here
okay.
We
there we go. All right.
Some bad masks.
Yep.
Really bad masks.
Those mouths are pretty weird.
Gaping.
Yes.
Why didn't they just make the masks with closed mouths? Like, now, maybe they, in retrospect, everybody agrees with me on this. Those mouths should have been shut.
Instead of...
Because when they're just hanging open, there's gaping, it looks so... That's what gives it away to me.
Right.
And see, we want freedom.
See, now, Zaius is like, okay, we're not... I mean, this just addresses what was going on at the time, because there were definitely... I mean, Kent State, I think, was 70.
Mm-hmm.
So Kent State happened during, while they were shooting this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were aware of it.
Very topical.
It was very, very topical at the time, you know.
And it's mostly all the intellectuals, by the way.
Well, intellectuals, the students.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
the ones who opposed the idea, and then you have basically the warriors saying, no, we're going to go to war.
Right.
We're going to war. And then we're going to arrest you and get you out of the way.
Yeah.
That's right. Which, of course, in these modern times, if we think about it, how much,
Topical social statements through sci-fi.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, if you relate it to now, you can make it what you will.
Yeah, you can always. And I mean, that's a great thing about good sci-fi, is you can always relate it to political situations that are happening.
It's not as controversial because it's cloaked in science fiction.
Yes.
And yet the audience knows exactly the statement.
Exactly what they're
saying.
Well,
it's almost
made.
Like you can accept it a little bit more. You can see it a little bit clearer without having to, having all the baggage of what's happening in the real world,
right?
Pulling it down, you can see.
You can absorb the principle much better.
Yeah, yeah.
And the interesting thing, if you think about it, is that is a huge crowd of apes.
That's a good. That's an epic shot. That's an epic shot of the
very big epic
series of this episode.
They definitely had like five cameras running.
Nice 2-3-5 composition there.
Oh, look,
far right
coming in on the far right.
Yeah,
I've never seen that before. Wow,
nice.
But the point is that here they're saying, "Fine, we're going to war." And what's the ultimate consequence of going to war? Planet blows up.
Yep.
See? That's what happens.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it happens when you mess with the Russians.
Everyone dies. That's what happens when you mess with Charlton Heston.
That's the most well-lit cave I've ever seen in my life.
That's a pretty quick heel there on that bullet graze.
Yeah.
Now, I got to say, them just sitting there, I got to say it's a little bit of weak writing.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's like a lot of time has passed.
Well, it's obviously nice and warm. They're sitting in front of a bank of lights.
Yep.
No, but what I'm saying is that in terms of any of the action moving, I mean, he found out that it's New York, and then what do we do now? There was no what do we do now.
We just chill.
We just chill and sit out. Now, of course,
they're tired.
We see what's... Why?
They just ran, Serge. They just ran, and they ran some more. Then they got on a horse, and then they fell off, and they ran again. and then they ran into a house, and they got in a wagon.
The stalagmites on the ground are awesome.
I always like to have a plan, and they don't have a plan.
They don't have a plan.
Even if they say, okay, I don't have a plan, and let's
take a plan. They probably wouldn't be rolling with me in the post-apocalyptic.
See? They would say, let's go down the tunnel. They would have gone down the tunnel or something.
Right. Look, but they don't even have weapons.
But instead,
who are these people?
Instead, they just stay where they are.
He's very defeatist of him.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying is I think it's part of the writing.
Mm.
They could have thought of something. Though, I mean, they do pick it back up now. Just in terms of the flow
of the story. I feel like the original script, the original draft, probably had a wonderful sequence that through budget was cut.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
And then, of course, and now then something happens. I mean, obviously he's got his thing. Actually, now this is where he looks out, and this is where he sees that they have followed and that now they have to move on. So now we're moving the sequence forward. So I guess the whole thing is they had to wait. And I guess waiting is not a very elegant way of writing, but you find ways of directing it or doing it. I'm just saying.
Right. Well, and maybe they wouldn't have been able to go down the tunnel. Like, they could have showed that. Like, they come to a dead end or something, and that's why they've just been hanging out.
Possibly, yeah.
I don't know.
But now it moves it forward because now he knows it's there, and now he has to go down the tunnel. And
right.
He has time because the Sarge said, don't do anything without me.
Right.
The ape said that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's like what you were saying earlier, Tim, about like, weren't you saying that they had kept on having rewrites all the time?
Yeah. Yeah. Through this
and that's
installment.
Yeah.
It was not locked before they started shooting.
It doesn't make me love this any less.
Just
pointing it out.
I was going to say, they had some really nice art direction touch there. They actually had dripping water going from the stalactite to the stalagmite. It was directly in line.
I saw that.
I thought that they didn't have to do that. That was very cool.
I got
to
say, we're 50 minutes in, and I am not disappointed with this film
in
the least. I'm still liking this.
Good.
It's not showing.
It's actually moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
I love the backdrop to extend the tunnel. That's awesome.
That's a nice mat.
Yep.
That's not a mat.
It's a backdrop. Yeah. You're right. I like the art direction. I just love it.
I
would love to play on that set.
Yep.
Let's see how far they run before
maybe
they
not
hit
barefoot.
The wall.
Yeah, maybe I don't want to play barefoot.
No. In my tennis.
If I would have been there with those apes, I would have been like, can you at least give me, you're going to give me some rags to wear. You want to give me some shoes? Come on. Right?
What they might have done is they might have put stuff, soles under their feet.
That would get
sort.
So old as an actor. Gosh.
But
day
still,
in, day
I'm
out.
Saying.
But walking on all that stuff, I'm sure they put something
as the astronaut. I would have demanded to have shoes because he's not used to walking around bare feet, first of all.
Listen, he's walking around bare torsoed, but he looks good.
Yeah, he looks great.
The guy has no body fat.
I'd rather walk around bare torsoed and have shoes on. I'm just saying.
Well, sure.
Something happens to your feet, you can't
nice
walk,
set.
Can't run.
The tunnel. I love that tunnel. I love that there's
the draft.
I love that,
yeah,
there,
like
I love,
hand
that,
is
I love
hair.
That there's a cave and they come around a corner. And then there's a tunnel with a ladder leading into it. It's just so cool.
I got a harebrained scheme.
I mean,
let's go over here.
I mean,
let's actually.
I mean, this is 9-year-old in me. I'm going like, wow. But somehow it's still, this is so awesome. What happened there with the grain?
Yeah.
It just got bad chance for me.
Well, that might have been the. Oh, I love that with the when he puts his hand on the ladder and the humming stops. Which introduces us to another anomaly of this. Now the next anomaly of the universe. This is now different. We haven't we've seen some of the hallucinations,
right.
But now we're getting more of a concrete.
It's a new world within a new world.
Right.
Exactly.
It's a newer world of the new world.
He's had two new worlds.
Which
he's
is
had,
nice.
He had the outside, the ape new world, but now
we have a third civilization. World. We have
you've got our 20th century mutant humans. You've got our 40th century apes and our 40th century mutants.
It's so clean.
And I think it's a brilliant idea also of having him touch it and then it goes silent.
It's eerie. It's nice for the ambiance of the...
It lets you know there's a sentience going on.
Yes.
Nice shot of her climbing that ladder.
I think actually all the shots in here are really... I think it's stunning when they walk around the corner and you just... That shining orb.
Yeah. And I like how the tunnel is... It's reminiscent of the... Well, the architecture of the tunnels, but clearly it was built... Separate from the subway stations,
right?
But it's got a sense of that architecture, and you've got the symbols now. So obviously,
and I love the new environment after all this prehistoric,
right?
Yeah,
stuff. Now we get to this clean, slick, sleek, modern.
And this is like a game, a video game.
Yeah,
your choice. Which tunnel do I go down?
Yep,
I would have gone down the last one. I don't know about you.
I don't know. This one looks like it's going somewhere interesting.
Well, I go down the tunnel and then I come back and I check out the other one and then I. You know,
then pick one.
Yeah. It's like, you got to test them out first. And now, of course, he gets his real taste of what it's like to be in New York. I got to say, I bet Linda Harrison had a hard time doing this role. It's like, I've just got to basically look like I don't know what's going on
ever
without furrowing my brow too much.
But I mean, she does that. She did that in the first film as well. She had no clue.
Yeah. And that can't be easy. This is all matte paintings.
That was nice.
Very well done.
Yeah.
And it holds up really, really
well. They do hold up pretty well. The bus was a little shady when they first came out. That one, I don't know if that.
New York Stock Exchange, Radio City Music Hall.
That stuff is shot. They shot that exterior. Walking.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even think that's James Franciscus.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Stand-in.
I think it's stand-ins. Yeah, I think even with Linda Harrison.
Yeah.
The second unit stand-in. Stuff.
Yeah. And that's no, that's not a stand-in. Oh, right. He's 51st and 5th. Okay. Let's see. Where are we?
I recognize it now.
Okay. I get it. And the humming stops. I think there's a pizza place around the corner.
Let's find out.
The best pizza in Manhattan. Actually, the best pizza in Manhattan, well, what do I know, is on 22nd and 6th, the southeast corner. I don't remember the name of it, but if you want
a great shot too.
If you want a good slice of pizza and you're in New York, go there.
Nice little investment on the set here.
Yep.
Of course, this is St. Patrick's Cathedral, I think. Or it's the implication it is. I don't know what's at 51st and 5th. But I bet you a cathedral of some sort is.
The right budget, even on top of what they're doing here, this sequence really could have been really awesome.
Oh, yeah. But I think they did really well
for what
they
had.
I mean, it's a combination of matte paintings and definitely, you know, art direction, building caves.
And, you know, what can be a run-of-the-mill assembly line cliche now, as far as themes and post-apocalyptic stuff, you know, this was big stuff for the time it was done. This was revolutionary ways of thinking for the most part in sci-fi movies.
Oh, absolutely.
So the audience, I can only imagine, were just hanging on every frame, just saying, my goodness, what's going on?
Well, but once again, going back, well, I mean, evidently, it captured it well enough that you know they kept on with the series. They were managing the world creation well enough that they could move on. I mean, they made five movies out of it and made a good amount of money. I don't know if it was Star Wars type of money. But
I hated this part.
You hated emotionally.
Yeah, what he's going
to what
do
he's about
here.
To do. Oh, this
I,
is,
I just
this
remember
is very
it
disturbing.
Disturbed the heck out of me.
This is a you know I'm remembering it too. This is very disturbing, and the way they shoot it's very disturbing because what they do is they do the optical cut in. So basically, they take the shot, then they zoomed in, they went to a closer focal length optically to get that disturbing effect, as opposed to cutting in. This was very disturbing. And clear. I mean, the problem, the thing is, that we see afterwards, it severely disturbs him of what happened. I don't think that's Linda Harrison, by the way. That is. And she's just like, "What are you doing? What did you do to me?"
Those bad mutants.
The bad mutants. You see, she's almost trying to talk there, very interestingly enough. So she's got the whole idea that you can't communicate. So, and now he's in there. Hang on, let me check and see what's at 51st and 5th. St. Patrick's is at 51st and 5th.
So that was St. Patrick's Cathedral.
This is supposed to be St. Patrick's Cathedral. The most famous church.
Very well lit cathedral, I must say. Where's that lighting coming from?
Yeah, it is extremely well lit.
It's coming from the bomb.
This is, yeah, really freaky, mind-twisty stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
I can only imagine 1970 taking your date to go see a sci-fi movie and watching this while you're munching your popcorn. Give me a break.
I mean, if you of course, you have the
depends on who your date is.
That's true.
I mean, as far as saying, what movie did we stumble into?
I think Heidi would like this when she'd be like, this is awesome.
What a great date.
Bombs, mutants. Oh, my. I'm digging this.
This is fantastic.
That's right. The world ends. Thank you so much. Gregory Sierra, one of his first appearances.
That's right. From Barney Miller.
That's right.
He was also in Towering Inferno. He was the bartender.
Gets killed at the end.
Yeah, the
poor guy.
The beam falls on
him. That's right. He had to have the beam. He couldn't survive. No, the beam had to get him. Yeah, very young.
Gosh, yeah, I wouldn't have recognized him.
But yeah, I mean, you have the reveal of the bomb, and essentially, of course, at the time, the whole thing with nuclear weapons, not that it's still not a concern, but it was very much a concern. But also, I think there was concerns about, and actually Dr. Strangelove had addressed this, the whole idea of a doomsday bomb, one that would just, like, essentially take out the whole planet, and that was tapping into that whole thing.
It was 6 years before this.
Right. Yeah, Strangelove was, what, 64? Yeah.
I like the way he played just explained laughs. The telepathy.
By himself to us.
Yeah.
See, that's what's awesome.
I like the reveal of that. By himself to us. Your lips don't move. I can hear what you're thinking.
I will now say everything you're saying. Now, that's...
it's an optical zoom.
That is optical zoom. Okay, the little ring around the rosy thing is in the comic. So they did a thing here in poster and rewriting. One of the mutants. So with the mutants, we have it's Paul Richards is the main guy. I love this that they have all the statues of the different Mendezes throughout the ages. So Paul Richards plays Mendez, whatever. Then you have Natalie Trundy. You have Don Pedro Colley, who was in THX 1138.
Hmm.
Then you have Victor Buono, who played King Tut in the Batman series. That's the first thing I noticed. I'm like, oh, that's King right. Tut.
There he is, screen left.
Yes, and then you have Jeff Corey, famous, at the time, famous actor.
This is a really great set. Another really great set.
Yeah.
Victor Buono rocked.
And I guess that's supposed to be Grand, parts of Grand Central.
Yeah.
I'm King Tut.
I love how the guy has to wear glasses, even though he's like advanced enough to speak through telepathy.
Well, he's got a mask that he wears underneath the glasses.
Do you remember Victor Buono and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
No.
If you want to see a fun Victor Buono role, watch Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Oh, yeah, he is in that.
He's the young guy that
Bette
Davis tries to get her career back on track with.
I love that film.
This film, well, these films, and this film still, do science fiction really well. In a concrete way that doesn't alienate you completely from what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not, I don't know, it doesn't seem cheesy to me. I mean, I'm watching it for the millionth time now. It still doesn't, I haven't seen it for a while. But here they're talking, you hear how they're talking with the beeps, and he gets to explain what they're thinking.
Right.
It's all thought out. It works.
I got to say, for a first film that wasn't designed for sequels, forget about it. It's incredible what they did and where they took it.
Well, the idea of the first film, I mean, just is riddled with possibility for sequels because it's such like a big concept and there's so much time. You know, there's so many unanswered questions. What's going to happen next? What happened before? It just builds itself for the kind of film
they created a universe.
Yeah, they created a universe. Exactly.
With potential.
Yep. That's a fantastic way of putting it. The girl. Oh, he doesn't know it's her name. That makes sense.
Right.
I hadn't really thought about it. These costumes are great, too.
So would you be disappointed if you're a classically trained actor in Shakespeare and this or that, and you have to play a mutant, and you never get to speak?
I wouldn't be, but I'm sure there's plenty of, people with their noses up in the air that would be.
If we could only all break out of Ape City.
I want to read their minds, too. Like, I want them,
Are you envious?
I wish I was tapped right in, yeah.
Envious of their envious. Power. A lot of electronic,
but I think that the sound effect and the quick jump cut editing actually really does help. You get that same kind of sense of like a headache, like he has.
Oh, he's got a big headache. Yep. Finally, now she talks. Speak. And of course, we can talk about the logic of them wearing masks. Why do they have to keep on wearing masks? Unless it's more of a religious thing, which I can get. But then the effort to make these masks, I'm just saying.
I'm just saying. It just doesn't make sense.
The mutant makeup is really awesome.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
And they went through like four different designs, I think, before they settled on it.
I love how here he just questions. It's a really interesting look at the clash of cultures. You know, here's, you take someone from one culture and you drop him into another one where, well, this is the way we do things. This is the way it is. And it's just, it really is alien.
It's really not that messed up. I mean, they're taking philosophies of real things as far as it's a weapon of peace. And really what is, you know, we have the bomb, the bombs are there, but we worship them. Well, for security, but we never have, and the fact that we're never going to use them, but you have to have them for the threat of using them.
Right, was the whole idea of mutually armed destruction. Or as they like to call it, MAD.
Oh.
No, that's what it was. It was they call it
an
MAD.
An appropriate mutually acronym? Armed,
yeah. Traumatic hypnosis.
Foreground fire.
I have to say, he had to act the crap out of this role.
Yeah, I really did. Well, for all the physicals.
But the thing is that he's a different kind of actor than Charlton Heston is, and Charlton Heston wouldn't have been able to pull off what James Franciscus did in this.
You think?
Because they're different types of actors.
In what way are they different?
I think in terms of how he deals with his physicality. He's got a very visceral sense to him. I mean, Charlton Heston's got a very solid, regal sense to him, and he's got a great voice, but I think the more physical stuff that he's doing, I don't think Charlton Heston would be able to pull off. Or
Charlton Heston did say that
it would definitely
be different. Yeah,
Heston did say that the original Planet of the Apes was the most physical part he ever played in his career. He barely made it through.
Right, but I mean physically expressive, not in terms of physicality. Physically, I'm talking about how Franciscus dealt with the whole hearing the you know. The thing in the brain, that kind of thing.
I see.
Not a lot of actors can pull that off.
That's true.
Jeff Corey.
Now, for me, this scene is going on.
It's a long.
They're stuck in this cave talking for a long time.
Well, they have a lot to explain and a lot of standing around. I mean, they have to cover a lot of territory. So, yeah.
I wonder how many days were spent shooting this scene.
And we get to know the whole explanation about how they're trying to defend themselves with the apes and everything. But what I don't get is that, okay, they can read minds. Why can't they get that he's telling the truth? And they still seem to insist that he knows what the apes are doing.
Well, because they're unaware of him. He's not, you know what I mean? He's atypical to anybody that they've encountered.
Right.
You know, so they can't really tell for sure if they think he's telling the truth or not because he's not.
It's not that kind of telepathy.
Well, right. And he's a complete foreigner.
Right.
You know, his understanding of everything that's going on here is, you know, his base level intelligence and understanding of what's going on is completely different than anybody else's, ape or human or mutant.
This, again, was disturbing, too.
Yeah, totally disturbing and weird.
Along, you know, like with the fountain scene.
Victor's face, man.
He's like in a different kind of madhouse than.
Well, I feel bad for Nova. Nova has no clue as to why he's doing this.
This is like Planet of the Mutants. You know, you had Planet of the Apes for the first film, and this is Planet of the Mutants. You know, he's got to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, he's got mutants on one side, apes on the other.
He's between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, which that's good writing.
Hmm.
And he was trying to withhold the information so at least he had
right,
some
so he wasn't
leverage.
Lying, but he was withholding.
Yeah, but he needed to have some leverage. And it's interesting, now that they go into the Forbidden Zone, they're like, okay. They see that it's not as...
Scary
yeah. and forbidden as they thought it was. I mean, it was forbidden because they created it to keep them... They created that to keep their civilization safe. We stay here, we don't die, because Forbidden Zone was full of radiation for God knows how long. And I'm sure it still is, actually. Because look what it's done to the mutants.
Yeah. And look what it's done to New York City.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that's not the mutation. That's the explosions. That's not the radiation, yeah.
Well, yeah. But whatever caused it.
I got to say, kudos to James Gregory. Yeah. Makeup, costume, yeah. out under the hot sun. Look
in
at
the
that.
Desert.
And looking fantastic.
Does that costume look like it breathes to you? I don't think so.
No, but it's a beautiful costume.
Sound the advance. That's
I like
great.
It.
I'm trying to remember what
beautiful,
I saw.
Yes, he was going to be sitting in that under the sun. Poor guy.
I think he was in an episode of MASH once. He was great as a general. He was a great comic actor.
He was, but he had that great gruff.
Yeah.
Gruff persona.
I had no idea who he was before this, but that's okay. I was young. Yeah, now it's dragging out a little bit.
Yeah. We're getting a little slow here.
Yeah, and in that sense, once again, it's like they had the kernels of the story. So is it the stories, is it the directing?
It's a lot of, you know, looking at people walking, looking at people marching, look at people being chased.
Is this turning into a little bit of like the Phantom Menace, like the Phantom Menace being the meeting film? This is not a meeting film. Okay, that was freaky.
Yeah, that's freaky.
With all those apes essentially hung upside down. I remember that freaking me out.
Now the masks where the mouths don't close make sense.
In awe. They're yeah. awe masks.
Right.
They work for awe. Ooh. Yeah.
Or terror.
Well, you know, they might have kept them open so they could actually maybe breathe.
Nah, we don't need these people to breathe.
And I see this is interesting, is that Zaius, who is... he's a man of faith, but a man of science... Oh, it's amazing. Actually, this is interesting. You're seeing them respond to something they do not... Oh, there you go. Ape shall not kill ape. That will come up in Battle for Planet of the Apes. And then they're seeing these things that completely horrify them, which is really pretty amazing when you think about it. And definitely relatable in some kind of way.
Controlling the masses.
Yeah.
Well, it's like... And in here he says, hold your... And then Ursus... Oh, now you have the lawgiver bleeding. Which you could only do in science fiction, really, because we know what the metaphor is.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty beautiful. Like, the imagery.
Oh, it is. It's pretty incredible. Of course, directing-wise, what they're doing, I wish they would do more. Wow, we're still God's chosen one. This is a vision. Oh, that's right. So it's Zaius. And so Zaius somehow makes the break and... figures out that it's a lie through his faith, in a way. He says, this can't be true. And, you know, if I die, I die. I go into the fire. And then this falls. But did they think it was going to kill him? This being the mutants, because obviously the mutants are playing there.
Right.
See, now that horse was freaked. That horse didn't like what it was. Okay, so now why did the mutants give up? Did they just say, oh, that's it, gig's up, they're not believing us?
Yeah, writing-wise, you would think the mutants would have assaulted them with more. But...
Having the lawgiver bleed wasn't a good play by the mutants.
Well, I think they threw everything they had and they said, we give up, all right, that's it. And then obviously Ursus is just like, yep. Wow.
There's a lot of extras to have out in the middle of nowhere.
That's some great acting through that mask. Let me tell you, with his body and everything.
Yeah.
The way he's... I mean,
he's taking it in.
When you've got... You know, the Earth is just like... That's what it is. Okay. They just explained it. They don't have the brain for the illusions, which is what Natalie Trundy explained. They could only do so much to give them the illusion that was happening, and the illusion couldn't hold.
Right.
All right. Okay. Yep. All right, so they explain themselves.
That's good.
All right. Yeah. I'll be okay.
Because they're thick skulled.
Yeah. Literally.
Thick skulled. Literally, yeah.
And figuratively. Nice desert shots, but let's get it on. Okay. What are we seeing?
It's good makeup on Gregory.
It's been a while. I want to see what he sees.
I like his close-ups.
That's a close-up.
I like seeing him see it. Yeah, there, cool.
I'd forgotten all about this.
Yep. It's New York.
And here we have.
So you see all of New York blown up, essentially. Mendez the second. So there's only been two. I thought there were more, like 10 or 15 of them.
How cool is a film composer? Now I have to write a mutant hymn.
Mm-hmm.
To the bomb.
Leonard Rosenman did an awesome job on this. We have essentially a religious ceremony around a bomb.
I love it.
I'm sure audiences were just freaking out.
Yeah.
Hey, Franciscus has a costume change. Good for you. Yeah.
But also in terms of what Paul Dina got to write with this.
Still
song,
barefoot, though.
Yeah, that's right. And they still won't give him shoes.
I'm pretty sure all the mutants are wearing shoes. Yep. They're wearing shoes.
They are so...
Why does everybody get shoes, but they don't get shoes?
Because they're still subhuman.
Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah, very Fortress of Solitude.
That came afterwards.
I know.
When I saw Superman, I'm like, oh,
is
it going to blow it up?
You only live twice, actually, right there.
Oh, that's right.
Blofeld's volcano.
That's right. And that was...
66.
No, you only live twice now. 68.
That was Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
That was 69.
That was actually 68. It was released in 69, but You Only Live Twice was 66.
They would have shot that in 67, my friend.
I like the idea of what
before.
He just said.
It was definitely before 68.
Well, back to this movie. I like the idea of what the priest guy just said about the bomb, because he makes a reference to, you know, the original explosion, whichever caused, you know, obviously what happened in New York now.
Right.
And I like that he says to a world without end, like, because it just, you know, proves that you can destroy it, but it'll always come back around. I think that's kind of cool for that to be like the base of their religion. It's almost kind of like reincarnation. It's almost a little like Buddhist or Hindi in a way.
Well, if you just look at everything that his whole ceremony of everything that he's reading, you definitely get an insight as to how, well, of course, Paul Dean constructed what their belief system is and what their belief system is in this film. And cue Leonard Rosenman.
I'm really excited about this.
I know. Oh, I remember seeing this. You get the
mask on a mask.
But you got the orchestra strike before it. It's like, holy crap. And of course, it's revealed to us when he sees it. Wow. Okay, Natalie Trundy is much prettier with the mask.
Questions. Why do they even wear those stupid masks?
This is what I was asking before. And then when they make the masks, why do they choose those faces?
Because they look like their faces. They just look like a more humanized version of their faces.
I guess, but why do they... But I think the reason they wear their masks is to basically remind themselves of... Well, I don't want
where they come from?
Who they were before right. The bomb, and that this is... But they cover themselves. It's if you want to look at it, it's like in Judaism, you wear a yarmulke. To say that you are, you know, that God is greater than you. So you wear that and you cover your head. In fact, some other religions do that too.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're covering themselves and only reveal themselves in prayer and reverence to the God, which is the doomsday bomb. That's a really...
Heck of a lot of makeup in this movie. All the ape stuff and now all the mutant sequences here.
Yeah, that's where the budget went, was all the mutant.
Yeah,
all
the makeup.
Can you imagine being one of those, you know, just hanging out on set and you're surrounded by people looking like that all day?
So did the mutants eat with the mutants and the apes eat with the apes?
Yeah.
Fellowship of the Holy Fallout. I want to get a transcript of this whole ceremony.
Me too.
Or get the screenplay. I mean, it just really reveals, but even the ape stuff, what they did in this.
I want to be married by the Fellowship of the Holy Fallout. do you think that's possible?
Anything is possible. Now, notice what they've done in terms of they've done an upside down cross.
Right.
As one of their symbols. But of course, you know, they are still cold-blooded. Because remember, they've trapped Taylor, and they've had him
right
jailed.
And he keeps on asking about him, and they all know that he's there.
Yeah. Don Pedro Colley.
Still won't give them real clothes, and still won't give them shoes.
Exactly.
I think these people are cruel.
Well, yeah, they are bloodless, and he says, you know too many of our secrets.
That's an awesome costume, the jailer guy.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that.
And there you go.
I wonder if how many people kept those things.
That is very kind of Adam Strange looking, his costume, actually.
You're right.
Yeah.
Hey, Chuck, welcome back.
I remember you with the Academy. Spaceship, Ape City Subway.
Oh, let's cover a lot of ground quickly here.
See, we got to get through it, yeah. Look how short he is and how tall Charlton Heston is, man. Yeah, Charlton Heston did more than 2 days on this film, I got to tell you. He probably did 2 weeks is what it is.
Hmm. That's peaceful. We don't kill our enemies. We get our enemies to kill each other.
Yeah,
you're still killing people.
Yeah, buddy. Mutant.
You mutant.
And here we go. Let's see how Chuck handles the psychic control. See, I think Franciscus beats Heston in portraying psychic control.
He does definitely make Charlton Heston look a little old, too.
Well, Charlton Heston was older.
Yeah, but you we haven't comparatively.
Yeah.
So his first scene with Charlton Heston is trying to kill him.
Oh, man. I remember that. I always remember that spike going into his back.
But there are no spikes poking out on that side.
No, that's when he went back. He did get jabbed in the back there.
No, he didn't.
Oh, he almost did.
And that's a stuntman on Franciscus. That's the same stuntman that was riding the horse.
Oh, it's the old foot to the camera shot.
Oh, yeah.
He did get.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. He went into that spike.
I think it's two stuntmen
I'm believing it's the two of them. It's okay.
I'm believing it.
This is interesting. Charlton Heston is a supporting character in this film. It's kind of weird. And they have to fight him. Yeah. He's probably like, Mr. Heston, I'm so sorry.
These mutants are fucked.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I'm like not on Team Mutant.
No, there's nothing to like about them.
And I generally like mutants a lot.
Yeah. Some of my closest friends are mutants.
Really? Oh, and now let's make it more interesting. That's right.
This, to me, again, you're just eating up running time.
Well, but I think this, I can accept it with this scene. You know, it is action. And well, the thing is, when you get into an action scene, then it turns into a part of the writing, but mostly the directing. And how are you going to direct it so that the action is sustainable, and then you can basically edit it so it's a sequence that keeps you.
Gosh, it's so very Adam Strange. Look at his little head.
Oh, yeah.
His little helmet.
Yeah, he needs to have a bit of more of the mohawk thing. Oh, he has some of the mohawk
thing.
That's
right.
Yeah,
he has that. Yeah, totally.
That's a great shot here, where Nova comes up. And the door is open, of course.
Because he doesn't even feel threatened. I love that. He's just sitting there in an open door, like not even feeling threatened.
Stuntman.
Yeah. And then here we go.
It's a good thing that those bars obstruct the face.
And she said Taylor. And that was a very big moment because he'd been trying to teach her how to talk, and she was mute, so clearly it showed that humanity had a chance.
Yeah, smush him.
Oh, yeah, they killed him.
That is good.
That was a great that's a great mutant death.
I like what you just said about humanity having a chance.
Right, yeah.
But here, but you were talking about this fight. The reason the fight had to be so long is so that we got some satisfaction with this guy dying. Only with that fight being as brutal as it was could you then get satisfaction in getting the catharsis of knowing, fine, I can actually try and beat my antagonist, which is what he wasn't.
I want to know if Heidi was satisfied since you weren't on Team Mutant. Were you glad that...
Yeah, I'm glad. And there's actually some blood shown, which also makes me happy.
That's right. And then, of course,
two for two.
He reveals his true most inner self. He takes his mask off, but now they're trapped in the cell. Damn it.
I know. I love that.
I hate when that happens.
I love that they open, but the door was open.
I know. But
these are two of modern day's most brilliant men, apparently.
You know, he was good.
And they opened the door and then they shut it on themselves.
James Brandt was great all the way up through to that point.
To that point.
You ever have one of those days where the world's taken over by apes, then you're in underground with mutants and you're locked in a cell with the dead mutants?
And you open a door and then you shut it on yourself?
Yeah, but that's
for no reason at all. For none.
All right. Picky point about here by the script, but here she just talked, and well, I guess they're more concerned about getting out than the fact that she talked.
Yeah, poor Linda Harrison.
And she's like, I just talked, and you guys are ignoring me.
Taylor.
I go two movies, and I finally start speaking, and no one pays attention to me.
Now here we go. He basically, and now because he hasn't seen, that's right, Taylor didn't see the bomb
and Omega,
and now we get the last big piece of information about this film.
Ooh, the precursor to the Omega Man. Charlton Heston said, and Omega.
Yeah. He went right into it. So now she's like, what?
Back to being stupid. She had a moment.
And now we get to see, Charlton Heston play. Now he starts playing out the whole last, I guess, what I'll call the psychic beat of this thing about where this is going. Because now they mentioned that this bomb will, that it's the doomsday bomb.
Yeah.
So now we know where this has to go. Who's going to accidentally set off the doomsday bomb? And I think we've, yeah. So in a way, this is the last act. Now we've got that last piece of information. Now we know where everything's going.
Yeah.
And you see, and that now it's just like we have to stop this thing. And that's strong writing.
You tell him.
Now that's some classic Heston. I love that.
Cut to the chase, pal.
Man, that's Taylor for you.
That's Taylor. Uh-huh.
That is Taylor.
Nihilist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was tailor-made.
Well, that's the thing, but the bomb, like I think I said before, I think, or we're talking about, the bomb is essentially the manifestation of Taylor's attitude about everything.
Hmm. Right. Which is a really shit attitude to have, actually, I think.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy with Taylor.
If you really want to stretch it to that, yeah. But in a way, it's a metaphoric... It's a manifestation.
Ooh, it's a metaphoric manifestation.
Well, I don't know. It's, you know, in other words, he was so cynical about it that, well, maybe, I mean, the way it's written, I don't know. But it's an interesting, in terms of telling a story, this is where his story ultimately led. It didn't lead to hope. It could lead to hope.
Well, if anyone's going to blow up the world, it should be a diehard cynic. And Taylor, his character.
Yeah, but it's exactly, and he has the choice at that last moment.
That bus is horrible. It's the only thing in that whole entire set that looks bad is that bus.
It made me feel like that was in camera. That was a glass, like on the lens.
It is, yeah.
Through that for a universal focus.
Right.
In order to combine the two,
The foreground.
Because the bus had a glass mat.
On the bottom, you also had that. And then you have, of course, the apes come in and just basically kill everyone. And they just, you know, you see something, you shoot it. Great.
They have no idea what they're doing.
And no one wins. The apes don't win. The mutants don't win.
Well, that's the thing.
Mankind.
No one has any idea. The apes have no idea what they're fighting. They just think they're fighting to defeat the enemy. And the mutants are like, well, actually, the mutants are, they know exactly what they're going to do. They're going to set off the bomb. Though, has it been explained that they don't know what the bomb will actually do?
Yeah, they were just kind of saying that in the cell, like they don't understand like what they actually have.
So mutants don't know. So these are the only guys who know.
They know it's a bomb, but they don't know it's the doomsday bomb.
They're John McClane, only it's not going to end well.
I don't know, because I don't have telepathy.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? I'm thinking just that. Well, I guess they do.
I'm thinking I want out of the ape series, blow up the world.
What are they thinking? They're thinking that they have to stop the bomb from going off. The idea would be destroy the panel.
Yep.
And this seals the deal. This is it.
Because she was it.
She was it for Taylor.
She was it for the world.
She was the world's hope.
She was it. She was, yeah, you're right. She was Eve.
But they did pretty much just let that guy just walk right up there and shoot her.
You know,
they looked at him, and then the guy shot her.
It was lame. I mean,
they're like, and you are.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Yeah, I'm thinking we're going to stand right here and let Nova get shot.
We're going to whittle down this main cast a little bit.
That's right. And you see, now Taylor just said, now it's time it was finished. So he's saying the bomb. It's interesting. Now, if you watch Charlton Heston's performance, it basically Taylor's just. He's given up. He had some hope before.
Defeatist.
And I was like, yeah. Because how...
Nova burned out.
Well, but how often in movies, you know, someone falls, someone dies, and no one's given the moment to, like, really say how I'm going to respond to them being gone, as opposed to, I'm okay, I'm carrying on, whatever. And then, of course, them coming through and basically now the mutants, essentially, how they've constructed their society, of course. That's right, because they made statues of their heads in the likeness of humans, which, of course, to apes is obscene. It's you know, that humans would be capable of doing something like that. Because when you think about this, this is their first encounter, other than with Taylor, with sentient human beings.
Right.
In their world.
Yeah, because they're all stupid.
They're exactly. All the other ones are like in Time Machine, whatever they call them, Eloi.
The Eloi.
E-L-O-I. Yeah, the
Eloi.
So for them, all the humans have been the Eloi, and now they're actually, this is their first encounter with human civilization, other than, once again, like I said, with Taylor, which also he was treated like a foreign organism.
Right.
Who had to be expelled and not understood and considered an anachronism. This is awesome. You gonna arrest him?
That creature.
James Gregory has a John Wayne-esque swagger.
Yeah, for sure.
He can
arrest that creature.
They've never heard a human speak other than Taylor, and he's like, oh. This is a great shot.
Yeah.
With the bomb coming out.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's right.
You guys did not
expect to march into the desert and find this,
right.
Did you?
You want to fuck with me? I'm going to fuck with you. It's a sergeant. Just kills him. That moment was always like stunning for me.
This is very serious stuff happening.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome guns.
Doesn't get more serious than this.
This is very serious because this is the end of the world. Yeah. We're watching the end of the world.
Yeah.
This is the scene. If you want to say,
again,
what's the scene of the end of the world?
And based on the madness, I'd say it's probably a good decision. This is what the world has become.
And even then, the way Paul Dean wrote this, I mean, it's concrete. It's like they don't understand it, so this is their God. Well, pull it down, destroy it.
Yeah.
You know, and
so Zaius knows.
Zaius kind of has a sense, but he doesn't know how it'll do it. He doesn't get it.
Right, but he's still a man of science, so he knows that there's something more to it.
Right.
Interesting that it's gold.
Ooh, that's a nice shot. That's a nice... looking through the cavern.
Idiots.
Maybe because gold is precious. Also, gold is a good conductor.
It gives it a godly appearance.
Yeah, it deifies it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it was bronze or zinc, it wouldn't be as interesting. All right, I don't get this part. I mean, I got that Brent's up there. This was always cool to me. And then it starts steaming out. I'm like, oh my God, that's not good.
No, it's not good. Okay.
Oh, that's right. Because then
if the doomsday bomb starts steaming, you are screwed.
And then, of course, you know, Ursus wants to press the red button. And, of course, James Franciscus knows, don't do that. So why don't you shoot him instead? Shoot Ursus. Please shoot Ursus. Oh. Instead he shot. See, the sequence of the who's shot here, I'm like, eh. But it's more cathartic here because basically he kills Ursus. And that's where you get your catharsis.
It's like a Quentin Tarantino ending.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is.
And then, of course, this was very upsetting. coming up in a second. Now we have, we're basically back to the cast from the first film.
Mm-hmm.
See, he knows.
I'm glad that it came back down to these two.
Yeah. Said, man is evil, capable of nothing of destruction.
Hey, what are you doing?
The apes and his
yeah,
gun,
what were the apes
jams.
Doing this whole time?
Exactly.
That's tough, right?
I was,
that
I was really upset when,
that's graphic.
When Brent got killed, and especially like that. And so look at this. Here's in. Here it is.
Clutching his heart.
And he said, you bloody bastard. This is 1970.
Yeah.
No one said that.
He got away with it twice. Yep. First movie he cussed, second movie he cussed at the end.
Here you go. End of the world. Greatest ending for a movie ever.
Through a bloodied hand.
I mean, deeply, deeply cynical, but it's all about, it all heads to that. It doesn't blink. I think that's Henry Silva. No. Henry or Howard De Silva. It sounds like Howard De Silva. It is intoning basically what happened to the planet. I mean, it's great.
Apjack Productions, Arthur P. Jacobs.
Yep. And that's...
There you go. That's it. That's it.
And, I feel giddy right now.
One of the satellites of that star is now dead.
That's right. I don't know about you guys.
A green, and then the way he says it, a green and
insignificant
planet is now dead.
One of the billions of...
And basically, it's like stretching out. You stretch all the way out, and there's a voice from out of nowhere.
Putting things in perspective.
Basically says that the world is gone, and it was insignificant. It came and it went, and essentially you did it. Lucius. This is what upset me about this. And we'll, you know, obviously when we do Escape, this becomes more of a thing. What happened to Lucius? I liked Lucius, man.
Which one's Lucius?
He was the nephew in he was at the very beginning, but he was in Planet of the Apes.
Lucius was, I remember him. Lou Wagner was in an episode of Lost in Space.
Lou Wagner, exactly.
I don't know about you guys, that ending makes me happy every time. I'm so giddy right now.
I just want to sing and dance.
I'm just glad that I made it through without getting shot. So,
well, consider it a significant accomplishment. Yeah.
I mean, if you're a human, to make it through this movie without getting shot is
significant. That's a dark movie. That's a dark, 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 dark film.
It's the Planet of the Apes, man. That's it, you know. It's a tough place to be.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you got mutants to the left of you, apes to the right of you, bomb right in front of you. What do we do now?
What do you do?
Blow up. I still don't think I would have blown it up, though. Me personally.
Well, but if now, but if you, but if you were Taylor, okay, and your Nova had been shot, and Brent had been shot, and the apes were just everything was for shit, and you didn't believe in anything,
but
and
there's
you're
still
dying.
Cornelius and the there's still people, there's still apes or whatever that are out there that are wanting something to be different, that are trying to make a change, and who am I to selfishly take that away from them just because I don't like what's going on?
But I'm saying as Taylor, that's the whole thing.
Right.
I understand what you're saying, but as Taylor.
But if I was Taylor, I would be Heidi, and I wouldn't have blown up the world.
I mean, I'm in agreement. I think it was deeply cynical. It was deeply cynical. But he had just given up ever any hope of anything good coming out of anything. It just seems like it was everything.
But then again, whose right is that to say this world is so unbelievably hopeless and fucked that I'm going to destroy it.
And I'd say the only person who can get away with it is Charlton Heston.
Right, I guess.
I don't think he's
but
right.
What is,
but that's the thing. I don't think it's about...
Right or wrong. It's about thinking about it.
Well, it's not about right or wrong or think about it. The thing is that it's... You're right. He is wrong in doing it. He shouldn't have done it.
No,
but the thing is that he had been so... His psychic landscape had been so just assaulted with everything that was negative from his world and from this world that he couldn't see any other way out.
Yeah, but you know what's fantastic is he was just about to die, and so then he would never have to think about that ever again, you know?
but he made the decision in it to...
If I go,
to,
I take to, it all with me.
I take it all with me. But, you know, I'm...
But
and, what, there, and there are some people who do that without, you know... I mean, you know, who do that willingly? You know, like Hitler basically wanted to scorch the earth. There are some people who in Batman says with Dark Knight says some people just want to watch the world
Ra's al Ghul.
But that's not Taylor. But is that the roots of what that is? I'm sorry, Tim. I just wanted to get through the thought.
We all have to keep it in context that with what Heidi said, that did Taylor have the right to wipe out the hope, which is Cornelius and other apes that wanted to do better?
No.
he actually didn't if we look at the next film.
Right, yeah. Right. No,
Did he actually do it, but through incredibly inventive writing, something, hope did go on.
Or my point about Lucius. Lucius died, you know. Or Zira and Cornelius, exactly. They all died. Who was he? But that's the point. I don't think the point is about whether he's right or wrong, because he is wrong, but it's what led him to be in that mind space where he did that, and then we can judge it and say, in that situation, I would not do that, just as you said.
Yeah.
I would not do that, because this person would do it. This person would say, fuck everything. Everything goes.
Right.
Nothing is worth anything.
That's a good mirror for people to hold up to themselves. Which person am I? What would I have ultimately
done? Am I the person who's ultimately selfish? Or...
Exactly. But when I say this is the greatest ending to a film, it's not that I would agree on doing it. It's just an expression of a thing that I would never, ever do, because it is wrong. But it taps into, like, our deepest, darkest psychic space that if I hate everything, then I would do that. But the point is, you shouldn't do it.
I guess.
But going back to your point, it's wrong to do it.
It's wrong.
It taps into, my point is that it taps into, he deeply wanted to do it because he went to that dark place.
Yeah, which made him the ultimate bad guy, actually.
You're right. He is the ultimate bad guy. Yeah, but he starts Planet of the Apes off as being the bad guy, but you're right. He is.
And that's Taylor's quote in the first movie was when he's keeping the log in the spaceship was, tell me, does man still make war against his brother?
And for that reason, if you take the thesis to the end, because man or ape still makes war against his brother, therefore he does not deserve to live.
I'm seeing a through line.
Yeah, that's his thesis.
Obscure way.
His through line and thesis. That's what he said it is. It didn't live up to it. I'm like, gone. Hmm. But you're right. He is, you know, he killed the world.
Yeah.
Bad Taylor.
Now, it could have been Ursus who accidentally killed the world. Or it could have been Mendez who was ready to... Well, but he didn't know.
Yeah, but it could have been all of them, but it wasn't them.
But Taylor knew. That's the whole thing. You're right. Taylor knew.
Taylor knew exactly what it was going to do, and he did it anyway.
Right. Taylor was essentially Shiva, god of destruction.
I think it'd be cool to...
Yeah, but not even in a good way. Because Shiva isn't just about negative destruction. It's also about tearing down to make new.
But maybe that's what he was about, too.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I kind of saw it was like the black hole.
Yeah.
The black hole of nothingness.
When he pushed that button down, I don't think he thought there was like a chance for anything to like be new. He just wanted it to all be over because he wanted it to be over with himself. He wanted everything to be over, which I think is really selfish. But
it's an interesting character arc.
Well, it's suicide blown up to genocide.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, he was dying, but essentially... Yeah, by setting it off, he is committing suicide and genocide. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would like to look at the first Planet of the Apes movie and listen to his monologue in the spaceship again and keep the ending of Beneath the Planet of the Apes in my mind as I'm listening to his words.
Right. Yeah.
And see how it jives.
But it is a big story arc or a big character arc to go from someone thinking that they are, from someone being somewhat a hero to being a complete villain.
Basically, in the end, yeah.
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 That's what you get.
Well, essentially...
That's what you get when you get apes and mutants together.
I don't necessarily call him a villain, but definitely...
I do.
Taking the wrong turn in one's personality.
I think I just realized for the first time, actually, ever, how much of a villain I think he is in this movie.
You see, I can't cop to...
Villain?
I can't cop to that, unfortunately. Yeah. Maybe I'll catch up to you at some point, but I'm like...
I mean...
Are you mad at him right now?
Yeah, I'm really mad at him.
You see, that's what I'm getting.
I'm really upset.
Is this the first time you're realizing you're really mad at him?
Yeah, I think this is the first time I've ever realized how much I'm mad at him.
Wow.
Yeah. I think maybe before I was just like, oh, them's the brakes. The bomb blew up. But now I'm really like, really realizing
you're
it.
Seeing his responsibility
in
it.
Yeah. I'm really upset. So
am I trying to explain maybe where he was going with this?
Yeah, I don't really care where he was going with it. Like, because I understand what you're trying to explain.
Okay, as long as you understand it.
I think that there's no explanation for that behavior.
Well, there's no excuse for it, yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can't forgive it. It can't be forgiven what he's done.
Right, it's...
So if you're religious, he's going to hell.
I guess, yeah, if you are religious, yeah. He's going to hell.
But there is no religion in this. I mean, there is ape religion, there's mutant religion, but there's no religion, no theology that we are familiar with.
In
a way, his crime is a crime against nature.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I mean, he's saying, instead of letting nature slash God or whatever take its course and do what it's going to do. But in a way, yes, Tim.
I
was going to say nature does take its course because nature allowed man to build the doomsday bomb and put it there for man to make his choice and to destroy it. And man does, embodied in Taylor, the ultimate cynic, make the choice and say, I'm destroying nature.
Yeah, it's pretty shitty.
So now what you need to do is watch the Omega Man and he'll redeem himself in your eyes.
Yes.
Because the end of the Omega Man
he does redeem himself very much.
He is the hope for the world.
I was watching
and he
Ben
dies
Hur.
For the rest of the people. Ben-Hur, yeah.
Ben-Hur much better.
But Ben-Hur always brings him back to
some
me.
Ten Commandments.
when you put Beneath the Planet of the Apes next to Omega Man, next to Soylent Green,
because I'm
looking
love
at some
movies.
Pretty caustic, dark
I love
that was statements and that Charles Heston did.
And that was his big trilogy. Quadrilogy, because this actually could be considered part of his.
The dark sci-fi.
Yeah. Absolutely. Everyone says Planet of the Apes, Omega Man, and Swan the Green, but definitely this was. This made a big impression on me as a kid, let me tell you. It was huge.
Well, especially, you have to put into context.
Obviously, because I said we have to do this film.
This was the first of the dark sci-fi, and this was the first. You have to think of the context of people that are seeing Ben-Hur. That's who Charlton Heston was.
Right.
And for Charlton Heston to do this.
Yeah.
And to betray the audience's expectations for what they know his characters to be most of the time. That's pretty risky.
That's
big
really
stuff.
Cynical. Wow. It's flowing through me. The deep cynicism that he.
I mean, Charlton Heston, you know, hero and like John Wayne type. And so you see, put John Wayne in the same position. John Wayne's the one that does that. And you're like, I just got fucked up.
That's what I'm saying. The only person who could possibly get away with it was Charlton Heston because he carried such, in a way.
Gravitas. And
Such, I would say, filmic spiritual gravitas. He had played Moses. He was Ben-Hur. He'd done El Cid. I mean, done all these things. Mm-hmm. These great,
bigger than life.
He's bigger than life great men. And it's the bigger than life great man who... I'm really surprised that he actually suggested I should blow up the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really... How did they even think of it? Like, oh, we have to blow up the world. I mean, because, going through the emotional steps, it's like... Holy crap, do you realize what you're doing?
I think you're
destroying the world. You're committing genocide.
I think
the world.
You're creating a story that actually embodies killing the world.
And you know what's interesting? We don't know what other kind of civilizations are on this planet because he doesn't. He doesn't know because he has been...
That's true. What's the rest of the world doing?
I was assuming they were all apes, but that's just me.
No, who knows what's happening in the Ukraine? I mean, who knows what's going on?
Well, and who knows what the social behavior is? Who knows what the political behavior is? I mean, we're seeing this very like tiny microcosm of what the future will hold, these apes that are like outside of New York City, you know? And he doesn't know what else is out there. He doesn't know what he's destroying.
The apes are not in planes, and they don't have transatlantic communication. So we don't know what's happened on the other side of the Earth compared to what we're seeing in our geography in these films. So really, when we talk about the ape universe, if you look at just the globe itself, there was more movies that could have been made
of what happened in other countries.
But my interpretation is that there was ape civilization around the world. Oh. It was apes around the world. In fact, if you read the comic after the movies, Marvel put out like a big black and white comic, and they did continue about that there were ape civilizations around the world.
Okay,
it makes sense.
It was set about 500 years before this.
Again. Taylor doesn't know what those if there are civilizations and what they're like. Maybe they are peaceful.
You're right. But there was Zira and there's Cornelius, and I'm sure there's others.
There's others like them. Right. You know, it's just. I don't know. I think that I feel kind of gypped as like someone coming because he's the representative of us. Taylor is a representative of our modern day civilization. The person that we're supposed to relate to. You know, coming into society, we've been born in the same time as him. We have the same ideals, quote unquote.
He's our emissary into this.
Yeah, and then he goes into this future and just like destroys it, just like his predecessors destroyed their own present. You know, it's interesting.
So really, that's saying that man's fulfillment and destiny is just to destroy
to destroy something.
Man you're looking at in the story,
but that was definitely
that's our ultimate destination.
That was definitely the sentiment at the time. Yeah. And people, you know, with the arms race, it's like, where are we heading? We're just going to destroy ourselves, and it's going to. I mean, now
I think it's
different. I still think there is that tendency for expansionist. I don't know. I still think there's always a desire to destroy, but once again, is it part of nature? Whatever. Well, I think the finer point I think I'm trying to get to with that is that with Taylor blowing up the world, do you think it's good writing and it was intentional and therefore everything, all these arguments hinge on that? Or was it maybe a weakness in the writing?
Do you think it's just like a cop-out just to say...
Exactly.
We're not going to solve anything. Let's just do it
and throw it out there. Or was it actually a logical follow-through?
I think as cynical as the foundation that was laid, I think is a logical progression.
Okay.
And I think that there are bad people. So I guess, you know what I mean? I think that the writing supports the scenario. I don't think it's completely out of left field. I think that it's... it does, hopefully, what its intention was to get you thinking.
Clearly it's doing that. And just the thought it gave me is that actually what Taylor is an anti-hero. And he was an anti-hero in Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. He was.
Yeah.
And this is actually, in a way, because...
It works.
You saying he's a villain, for some reason, was just like, oh, he can't be a villain. But maybe what it is he's the anti-hero.
Well, I don't know. I think all great villains are constructed that way, where once they were people you understood... Once they were people with purpose who became motivated by other, other feelings and ideas at some point, you know, that's what a good villain is not someone who just woke up one morning and was like, I'm going to do bad things. It's someone who progressively became that and has a whole justification in their mind why they do the things that they do. That's what makes them harder to fight. And that's what makes their, just raises the stakes of what they're doing.
Hmm. Well, this is a very interesting point because, see, I see it, he's an anti-hero. I don't see him as a villain. I see him as the ultimate defeatist.
Yes.
That's the ultimate defeat.
Yeah, once Nova was killed,
I don't see him inflicting...
I don't know. I think that is kind of evil. I mean, in my own personal beliefs of life.
Yeah, so if you're going to be defeatist,
I think people are quitters.
If you're going to be a quitter and defeatist, let it sit with yourself. Do not make others pay for it.
Yeah, don't project that onto someone else. And if you're that way in yourself, I think you've already lost.
But that's interesting because that was a weakness in his character. I mean, in a way, Taylor was a weak person because he couldn't deal with what man would do to man, and he just wanted to get away from it, and he was the ultimate cynic, and he had no faith in mankind, and he was weak in that sense.
Yeah.
And it was his weakness that allowed him to say, I screw everything, because he couldn't overcome what I was calling the darkness of the hole.
Right.
He didn't have the strength to say, no, I will get beyond it. Even in my moment of dying, I will say it will get better.
In standard writing,
you just accept it. You don't have to get over it. You could just accept it.
Right, but they chose instead to have him continue down that weakness.
Yeah, standard writing his character arc would have been, It's a Wonderful Life. And he would have started out the way we saw him, but his arc would have been to embrace humanity and the faith that's restored, and he grows, and he's added unto because of that.
But that's his anti-hero arc. His anti-hero
arc. Anti-hero arc is the fulfillment of the groundwork that's laid in the first movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man does suck. I'm not strong enough to overcome it. Wow.
And I shall bring it.
He was weak.
Ending.
Wow.
Yep. You know. So really, in his mind, wouldn't you think he's doing something charitable? He could see it as charitable.
Which is why he's a villain.
Exactly.
I need a new racket for this game. New tennis racket as we go back and forth.
I'm tending towards the anti-hero. Argument.
Well, but, I suppose
an
history
is someone who does things in a wrong way, but does them like for the betterment of everyone. Not someone who thinks that they're already doing everything the right way. You know what I mean? Like an anti-hero is like a former convict that ends up like saving a little girl. That's an anti-hero. You know, an anti-hero isn't someone who was a hero and then just like gives up.
I don't see Taylor as ever
and killing everybody.
Being a hero.
Oh, but he definitely was a hero, but that's the point.
He was an anti-hero.
But if you look at him during the whole first movie, he's basically, because he'd given up on everything, and the whole first movie is a metaphor for him having given up. He gets it all thrown in his face. Man is now completely, a savage, and apes rule, and he is nothing, and he has to explain his existence to these people. I mean, it is truly... the existential experience. And so then here the existential thread is pulled further. I mean, he's sent away for the whole movie, and then he's searched for, and then Brent gets to fill it in, and we get to see a whole bunch of other stuff, and we come back to it. The thing is that now he gets to come to the end of his journey and find out that the true manifestation of all that is, you know, the doomsday bomb, the bomb that will completely take everything out and say, well, you're so cynical about everything, it can just go. Well, let's try and stop it.
But what did he do that was heroic in the first movie that he's a hero? To me, it was self-survival. I didn't see him doing anything that was trying to better others.
He saves Nova.
Which is sort of selfish in itself.
He's the leader, but he's the leader. Okay, maybe it's not fair to call him the hero. He is the protagonist in the first movie.
Yes, correct.
He's an astronaut, but his
motivation for what he does is really self-survival through so much of it. It's not.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So even having Nova, that's not altruistic. It fulfills a need. Female companionship, this hot babe, you know, and plus it represents, you know.
And back to supporting my Taylor is a villain argument.
I just see him as not being a hero, the groundwork and his whole character.
I think to come to this ending makes
sense.
I think why I'm not necessarily agreeing with the villain thing. I see what you're saying, but the villain usually. The protagonist is the hero, and if he's a bad hero, then he's an anti-hero. The villain is always the antagonist, the one who is against your protagonist.
But in this film, he isn't our protagonist in this film, actually.
No, he's not. But he's kind of like the sub-protagonist because he was and he's sent away. Brent becomes a protagonist, and of course he's a good guy because he's an astronaut.
But he's almost kind of the antagonist because everything Brent's doing is to look for him, to find Taylor.
Right.
So
well, he's the MacGuffin then.
So he's pushing him to follow the path he's following.
Okay. But he never tries to get Brent to think his way. That's the thing, and that's why I think you can't really apply to that. Then when Brent gets killed, then he becomes, in the last 30 seconds, he becomes the protagonist again, or when talking to Zaius, and then we're essentially back to the first movie.
But I still don't think Brent would have blown up the planet.
No, Brent would not.
No, Brent would not have.
Brent would not have, but that's why, ultimately, the framing structure was actually really clever, because it started off with Taylor goes away and then comes back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting play.
I still think he's a villain. You can't talk me out of it. It's just not going
to
happen.
I wasn't trying to. We were just exploring the ideas of this spring.
I think it's a very interesting.
But I think the greatest ending in movie history deserves discussion like we're having right now.
I do too. I think that's why it does it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you know any other ending that would provoke such discussion?
Do we have another character that we would have favored more as who would have blown up the planet?
No.
No, like I don't think anybody else would have.
Because the only two people who knew were him
and
Brent. Nova
could have sat on it.
Ursus or Mendez were going to press it, but they didn't know what it was really going to do.
Right.
So, I mean, even if they would have caused it, they didn't have the concept of this is destroying the whole planet. If any of those other characters would have known it was going to destroy the whole planet, I don't think they would have pushed it.
Right.
I don't think any of them would have wanted to sacrifice the entire planet just for a win in that moment. No, I don't think so. I think the only two that really understood what was going on...
Taylor and Brent.
Taylor and Brent. Brent would never do it.
Nope, I don't think he would.
Because he was full of bullet holes.
Well, that's part of it.
That was gross, let me tell you.
That was a good impact shot. That was really great.
That was well done.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
And he didn't have much protection. I mean, if they're doing squibs or something around him.
Right.
Well, I think if you watch it, you didn't see the squibs go off. They did it in different
ways.
It was around him, in the background.
It was
around him, and then on him, they had the makeup on him. So that's how they did that.
But still, I wouldn't want to be bare-chested, bare-backed, and things are exploding behind me.
He was doing that.
So good to James Franciscus, all the physicality he did with his brother.
Yeah, he was great.
He passed away. You know that.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
He passed away a few years after I...
It was
I think
it was cancer, right? Oh, you met him.
I met him. I told you that story. Yeah, please tell our audience. I lived next to his mother in Carefree, Arizona. Lafarge was his mother's name, and he'd come visit her every so often, and I'd see him. And then one day I was working in a video store. I managed a video store.
Oh, that's right.
And he walked in to rent a movie. And I go, oh, my God, there's James Franciscus. And he goes by Butterfly, the movie with Pia Zadora that he was in. And I remember him saying, oh, there's a winner. He kept on walking. He's a great guy. And then I talked to him a bit, and he signed for his movie, and I kept that receipt, actually, with James Franciscus.
You still have it?
Yeah, somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah. But a really great guy.
But he passed away, I think, in the 80s of cancer.
Cancer, yeah.
It was a shame.
He smoked a lot.
Yeah. But I remember after this, he was on Long Street. It's like, oh, cool, it's Brent and everything. Mm-hmm. But I thought he did a great job.
He's always been one of my favorites. I always
liked
James
Franciscus. He's fantastic in this.
Yeah. And Linda Harrison hats off to you. You did good work. No, I mean, she was fine for what she had to do. I mean, she had to, she was in the whole other film too. So she got to do two films without, you know, only saying, Dilla.
And I buy it. I mean, she does really portray a believable idiot.
Whoa.
She does, though. She does. She has that thing when you look in her eyes and, like, you don't see a soul, like the Kardashians. You know what I'm talking about?
Wow.
There's no lights on inside.
There's a few other people around Hollywood who are like that, too. Oh, yes.
But oh, yes. She, I mean, she does do a good job of it.
She does a good job of acting like that, but I don't think she's like that.
Right, yeah, but of like being all like spaced out and just looking completely unaware of what's going on. I mean, she really does look that way the entire film. Like she's completely unaware.
Films.
That's right. Two films.
So.
Well, that last moment, yeah, I'm going to have to think about it some more. I know there's like a thought nagging in the back of my head, but there's no way to articulate it. But this has been a good deconstruction of that ending. I'm grateful for this.
It totally works for me.
Oh, it totally works. I've been chomping at to really discuss it. Yeah.
And I'd say kudos to Charlton Heston for doing that as in his career.
Yeah.
It took a lot of balls.
Oh, absolutely. This was the way to end this film. I mean, it really symbolic level and everything, and on the character level, you're right. It does. It makes them
very dramatic.
Yeah.
Not a very.
So if you're going to be as cynical as possible, then you're going to add Ben-Hur and Moses blowing up the world.
Yeah,
on top of it.
Basically,
so,
that's what it is.
Wow. It's like as dark gets.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always wondered where they would take the series after this because they've just blown up the world. So who knows what can happen next?
How could they possibly have another movie, Serge? It's not possible.
You know, I think what we should do is I think we're going to have to watch Escape from the Planet of the Apes at some point. And do a commentary for that too. So.
But I will say, from what I said in the beginning, it still emotionally upsets me. It's still dark. It's not something I would naturally gravitate to watch.
And you know what holds up? It really, for the most part. I mean, other than a few production quality things,
it holds up.
The 2-3-5 holds up well.
The ideas are wonderful. It's execution. You know, we have those really. Chase, walk, walk,
right,
walk.
Right, right.
Eating up the running time.
And I think that's more the function of the directing. And also, and probably the schedule, which was severely truncated.
So the kernels that are there as far as the storyline and ideas to be presented
are
some wonderful things.
The ideas, the acting, the sets, the costumes, the music. You know, there are a lot of aspects that are solid. And I think that those are the ones that, you know, that's what keeps it from, you know, aging, and that's what keeps it worth watching, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes it. That ultimately makes it concrete and just lets us see it 40 years later. This is a 40-year-old film. Holy crap!
It is.
If you compare it to when it came out, then you would have compared it to a film that came out in 1931.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
That's really weird.
It is strange.
Not getting younger.
I wasn't talking about that, but it's just kind of weird. But it's cool. All right, so that was Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and I think I'm going to go have a banana. Oh, no, that's another movie. Okay. All right. So this has been Serge Dalpierre and...
Tim McMillan.
And...
Heidi Hilliker.
And this has been Film Grok. See you next time.